I'd like to call the Legislative Task Force on Child Protection to order. We started just a couple minutes late, but we'll still have plenty of time. Just a couple of housekeeping things. We have sign-up sheets in the back. There is one that we started, and Kayla has the sign-up sheets in the back, but we're also going to take this one back. There was several people who signed up. If you could just put your organization and title, there's just all we have is names here, so if we could just get some more information, that would be appreciated. So we'll run that sheet back. So if you signed on that sheet, please fill in the other information. And testifiers will be limited to 3 minutes. But I do have people that have called ahead of time. We have 20 minutes for the Ask Me Council 5. We have Mr. Mitchell, Ms. Kane, Mr. Gehrman, Ms. Shordahl, Mr. Lear, Dr. Hohensteiner, Ristel Pun, and Ms. Baker, I believe it is. And so those they have already signed up, just so you know. So they're already on there, so you don't have to sign again. But if you could fill those out, that would be appreciated, and we will get to that as soon as we can. And the handouts are in the back, again, with Kayla. There's some handouts we'll probably reference as we get going. The first thing on our agenda is we need to approve the minutes from the 6/27/17 meeting. They are, members should have it in their packets, and I believe they're back in the back. I would entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
So as moved.
Senator Eaton moves that motion. All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The minutes are approved. We're going to move on to reviewing the recodification language that we have been discussing. And I do have a Senate Council is going to go through, and I'd like to open up a discussion with the members after they go through that. We have two, there are two versions. If some, I believe, and Senate Council may be, Senate Council, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, I think you went actually through a recodification at a meeting last
and what summer, I was looking right. for is just that newer version with right. the changes. Yeah. I know we're going to go through the changes. We have that. And so if you feel like it would be easier just to go through them as one agenda item, as I was looking this morning, I thought maybe it would be easier. But I would like to have us go through those changes because of the 2017 right. legislation. And then I would like, if there's any questions from the members, because I think that the Representative Creech and I are looking to potentially have the task force kind of okay it without taking a formal vote, just saying this, I think we'd like to see this as legislation. So if we could go through and maybe those changes. I understand we went through the older version last time, but if you could point out changes and then we could take questions or discussion from the committee.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, actually the only changes that are made in these documents are to engross in amendments that passed last session. So there was no actual reworking of the recodification language itself. So all that you see here is just is things that were enacted and what the law would look like now if you melded it all together.
Representative Creech.
In the recodification.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as I understand what you're saying is the bill that we went through last year, the tome, the 3.5-inch thing, the only updates you did was to incorporate anything that had passed in the last legislature to make it current. So
yes.
The recodification that we had that puts like things with like things and brings it all together is as it was with just an update of what we passed. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
That's all that's in here. It was just a clean document so you'd be able to track it a little better. But
And the clean document would be the LCB 1801. Is that correct? -01. That's the one I'm looking
yeah,
at.
Yeah, Madam Chair, yes, that would actually show you all the language put together.
All right, and I believe members have that in their packets. And I realize that it was a while back now that we went through that. Is there any discussion or questions on this? Because I think, and Representative Creech, correct me if I'm wrong, but we were kind of looking for an okay that we could have this put together and put it into legislation for session. Representative Creech.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, members, just to help you out, so last meeting, the impetus is when we make changes to the 626 statute, a lot of times there's references all over the place. And for the revisers, I mean, it's just a nightmare to make changes because things are all over the place. Our goal in this that came out of the Child Protection Task Force, the governor's 2015, was to recodify this and to restructure it so that we could make those changes easily and so that people in the field, whether it's county attorneys or courts, when they go through the statute, it's easier to follow and we can do that. So that was what was in front of you. And Chair Fischbach is absolutely correct. What we're hoping we can do is just get an okay. I mean, you've had some time. Hopefully you've had some feedback on it. If you haven't understood, it'll still move through the legislative process. But I think our goal would be just to get the nod to that, yeah, this is the right step, this is the right approach, knowing that it's still going to have to go, still going to need to go through the legislative process.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to double check. So in this document with the 01, there's no new legislation that has not been passed. We're just reorganizing current things and adding the amendments that we passed last session. Is that correct?
Make
sure I understand. Okay, thank you.
Any further discussion on the recodification bill? Well, that was easy. We'll hope it goes this quickly during session. but then I guess we will, seeing no objection, I guess we will go ahead and prepare it for legislation for next session. All right. We will then move on to Mr. Koppel. Did I see Mr. Koppel here today? Oh, maybe he was right. We weren't quick, or we were too quick.
Oh, I think he's outside.
Oh. Because I thought I did see him here.
You're looking lovely today, Mr. Koppel.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Kreisha, yes,
obviously I'm not.
The floor.
Obviously, I'm not Jim Koppel. He is out in the hallway, and we are just grabbing him, so it'll be a few minutes.
Okay. Thanks. Well, and just so that members know and they can dig it out of their pile, we're looking at the implementation planning document, and they did get an updated version for us, so that's what hopefully we'll be looking at. Because as you recall, we didn't have the updated version at the last committee meeting. Mr. Koppel, we were very quick. We did things very quickly. So,
thank you. Sorry to keep you waiting.
Not a problem. So please, whenever you're ready, Mr. Koppel.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair and members, my name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. And I'm just going to briefly, we sent over last week, and I think it was sent out with some of the materials for this meeting, the implementation planning document. Does everyone have that?
And, Mr. Koppel, everyone should have it in their packets. If you don't, let us know. But it looks like folks are indicating they have it. So thank you.
And, Madam Chair and members, this was discussed briefly at the last meeting. And I know that Senator Fischbach had asked that we update this and bring it to this meeting. And in doing that, what we did was we simplified it a little bit. So it's comparable to what we had previously done, but we just limited it to two columns. And basically the reason being, on the left side is the recommendation from the task force. On the right side is the activity that has taken place or needs to take place in order to implement each of the recommendations. So in the older document, we had red, yellow, and green. There was some dispute as to when we said it was green, we felt we were done. Some other people didn't think we were done. So rather than make a judgment that something's done or not done, we just simply outline what we've done, stated it, how we have addressed it, but we didn't necessarily draw those conclusions as we had in previous documents. I'm not going to go through this document this morning. I would say this, that significant work has been done. There are a lot of these recommendations that have been adopted. There are a number of reasons in moving forward for some of the some of the recommendations that have been discussed in the past either need statute change or funding or both in order to do. I know that the substantial child endangerment language that was part of the recommendations was part of the of this committee's work last year to come up with that language, but I don't think there was any legislation introduced, but that would be the an example of something that that's where it is in progress, and that's how it's stated in this document. I would say the from a practice vantage point out in the field, the impact of what we've done to date has changed significantly. The way we screen cases that come in, county screen those cases, and what is screened in, what is screened out, and what is investigated, et cetera, so that we have clear practice guidelines in this state, which I think are for the most part being practiced uniformly, which means that we have training and repeated training to make sure that those guidelines are followed. As a result, we have seen a great increase in the number of cases screened in, and we have seen a great increase in number of investigations. We've seen an increase in out-of-home placements, et cetera. So one of the recommendations that I mentioned last time was caseloads. One of the recommendations was that the caseloads for caseworkers should not exceed 10 cases. A caseload typically is every child in the family. So when you're talking about 10 cases, you might be talking about 30 children. It just varies by the size of the family. We have far exceeded that. I don't know of any county other than Olmsted County, which has invested substantial county dollars, that has a lower caseload than 10. So we have a problem there, and that we have a as a result of the changes we made, which are good changes. And it's not that inappropriate screening is going on or cases are being screened in that shouldn't be, but it just taxes the system. And the investment that we made back in 2015 basically was made to make up for the cuts that had happened a decade or so earlier, but it did not anticipate the growth in the system that we've seen. So there's a lot of pressure. And the second thing I would mention that I think is a really important recommendation is the staff retention and training, the staff support that we have to have in our child protection system. Because we have seen a great growth in the number of cases, we also have seen, and we funded, the legislature funded in 2015, additional money to add staff. So there have been literally hundreds of new staff hired over the last 2 years across the state. But there have also been hundreds of staff leaving. The retention in this work is really tough. It's tough work. And to the new staff to be properly trained and brought into the field, when I go out and meet with counties, that training can go on upwards to a year in length because of the availability of the training and the availability of staff to attend that training. That's tough. You don't want to put new people in the field not properly trained. The work is way too dynamic. Families are way too dynamic, and the issues we're facing are way too dynamic to do that. We need to have a really vital training academy where modeled after other states like New Jersey that have done this, where you have people come in and do intensive training, go out, work in the field, come back in. It not only provides better training, but you also are dealing with the secondhand trauma that a new employee is facing. This is a tough business. The second thing is just in terms of retention, all of you are invited to a collaborative safety training that we're holding later this month. Those you may not have seen it, but the 24th and 25th of October, it's a two-day training. It's something we're instituting. We've trained over 1,000 folks statewide at this point. It really is trying to look at the outcomes that we get that we don't want, like child deaths or near deaths. How do we fix the system in a way where we're not going to get those outcomes again, as opposed to what we do sometimes is just blame somebody and then move on, when it isn't just somebody that's to blame. It's really the way we've set up our system and the way we respond, or how we respond and how we allocate resources. So this is a very vibrant change in the way that we look and support our workers. Our workers work, county social workers work way too hard and have really, really tough jobs to be criticizing every move they make when they are already feeling tremendous stress just from the families that they work with. So what we're trying to do is work with our county partners and with our social workers to get to, why are we not having better outcomes than we have? What is leading us to the outcomes we don't desire? And having real good, safe discussions with those workers. It's changing the relationship we have, and very well received by counties, but also very well received by our staff. It's collaborative, and it feels much better to take this process. So that training is a two-day training. I've been through it. I'm going to go through it again with this next round, just because I don't like trainings or meetings any more than the next person, but this was a tremendous training. It is two people out of Tennessee, the deputy commissioner who instituted this in Tennessee and is now on the road with it. And they're working in a number of states, including Minnesota, and moving this forward. So that training academy with this collaborative safety model, along with other innovations to retain staff, because we have to retain the staff we're bringing in now, in order to meet the needs of families. We need experienced staff. We don't need to lose them. So I call those two things to your attention. Resources are short, and counties have a lot of money in the game now, and the state has money in the game, and I know that the budgets are not going to be big in the future, but I just had to call those two things out because I think they're probably as relevant as anything. I want to emphasize finally that in no other business is the social worker, the connection to a family, so important. You have caseworkers. We have caseworkers in a lot of programs, MFIP or SNAP or, other programs where you have eligibility workers or employment service counselors. But this worker is the life link to that family for strengthening that family, for making sure that that child gets to permanency as fast as possible. So that worker is so instrumental in the success of our child protection system. And that's why I'm spending so much time talking about workers today, because I think that's the key to success. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I'd also be happy to come by anyone who would like to review this and go through it in a more one-on-one way. We are available. Come by and stop by anyone's office or offices or however you would like to have this reviewed, Madam Chair.
And Mr. Koppel, I just had one quick question. I know that we went through it quite a bit, the older version. Was there anything that was updated other than the kind of the layout? Was there any of the items that were updated from this version or the last version to this version that you could just maybe briefly
give
us?
I know there is. And if you don't mind, I'd have our division director
absolutely
come up, Jamie Sorensen.
That would be wonderful.
He knows this document a little better than I do. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. And just looking for changes from the last document to this document, since and if it was just the layout, that's one thing, but wondering if there was anything substantial.
Sure. Jamie Sorensen with the Child Safety and Permanency Division. I'm the division director. And Madam Chair, we didn't track all the updates in this document, but in several of the areas, updates were made. And so as I look at the document, I would really just be probably have to thumb through and off the top of my head share the updates, which I don't know that would be particularly helpful for you. So if you would prefer a more a document that has more of a tracked change indicating where there are updates, I think we could provide that.
I think we're, did you, okay. Does the committee want to go through it quickly now, or would they prefer like the actual track change? I thought we were going to get something that would track the changes, and so I'm sorry I misunderstood what we were getting.
And I'm sorry, Madam Chair, and we can, but what we did when we updated this was also change language, you know, how we talked about things as completed, or and it was more instructive. So we, in changing the format, kind of gave it an overhaul, too. So they're not just changes in terms of progress made, but also just the way we worded it. So I apologize, and it's not comparable to the old, but I think this will be a more instructive and valuable document going forward. And for in between now and the next meeting, if you'd like, we could go through and say, you know, for those of you tracking changes, these were the changes made in terms of progress, not so much wordsmithing, but progress made. Would that be acceptable?
Actually, Representative Kreisha has a question right now, and then we can figure out how we want to handle that. Representative Kreisha.
I think maybe one thing to be helpful, and Mr. Sorensen, if just give us three things that changed, you know, top level, what three things are probably the most important, and then what three things, and we won't hold you to it, but what three things would you like to see done in the next upcoming 6 months? So just show us a little bit of progress.
So in the document, there is, and I'm not going to be able to reference the number of the recommendations, probably, and point you to them because there's 93 of them, but in terms of our work related to our response track for cases where there's co-occurring child maltreatment and domestic violence, there's been a great deal of work done with stakeholders throughout Minnesota to develop a practice guide that is currently under final review and is proposed to be released in the fourth quarter of this calendar year, and that will provide guidance and instruction to local child welfare agencies, county and tribal, in terms of how to screen and respond and work with those cases where there is, again, a co-occurrence of child maltreatment and domestic violence.
And Mr. Sorensen, I might ask, you said that is something that's already in progress, so maybe just step back. You said that was something that was you're working on and will be presented soon?
Yes, that's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Have we issued any guidance in the last 6 months?
Yeah. And Madam Chair, also, we have released guidance for responding to cases where there's prenatal exposure, and that is guidance that was developed through, again, a stakeholder group and has been released and distributed to local county and tribal child welfare agencies and provides workers with instruction on how to ensure the safety of prenatally exposed infants and to work with them in terms of child welfare response and investigation in situations where that's necessary. And the reason it's taken me a bit to kind of highlight these is, as you see this in report form, this is a fluid working plan, and so it's changing constantly. And this is what we use to track really what we've completed, what we're applying staffing, fiscal, other resources to currently, what we have really prepared to the point where it's positioned for required either legislation or funding. If you look at recommendation number 93, and maybe I can jump to Representative Crescia's portion of the question relating to what's teed up next, I guess I would echo what Mr. Assistant Commissioner Koppel is referencing. And if you look at recommendation number 65, that is a recommendation regarding enhancing how we develop child welfare staff in the state, how we attend to their well-being and trauma impact from this work, and how we focus on their retention. And there's been a great deal of work with the Center for Advanced Studies in Child Welfare at the University of Minnesota, a large number of county partners and others who've come together to develop a model with a fiscal analysis that we believe is really important for improving what happens with kids and families in Minnesota. And so you'll see that, again, highlighted in recommendation number 3 as one of the things that we would like to see happen. Again, as Mr. Koppel, Assistant Commissioner Koppel, referenced, addressing the recommendation related to caseload sizes, and that's recommendations number 78 and 87. We believe that the supervisor to caseworker ratio is paramount, and also the caseworker to client ratio. To accomplish what we require child welfare workers to accomplish with each child welfare case, the caseloads need to be right-sized, and the community resources need to be available for them to ensure child safety, to address well-being, which gets into their physical health, their education, those kinds of things, and then also how quickly they move to a permanent family.
Okay. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Sorensen. So what I'm hearing, and, you know, I'll just throw it out there, it seems to me that going back to the 2015 task force recommendations, we've gotten to a point now where we've made as many substantial changes as we can with the resources available. What I think I'm hearing in some of the meetings is, in order for us to continue to make substantial changes or improvements, we're going to need to reexamine the resources that are available and increase those. Is that fair? I mean, that's why we're here.
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, yes, to some degree. There are some things still in progress. We are pursuing some relationships with some national groups for best practice guidance, and we will continue to issue those. But yes, there are significant issues that remain, and they will require resources or minimally statute changes in order to implement. And additionally, you know, much like Mr. Sorensen mentioned, the opioid problem that we're having and trying to develop, there are emerging issues that we try to meet. So not all of our time can be spent implementing these. We are trying to develop a first-class child welfare system in Minnesota, working with tribes on we have 2 tribes right now moving into initiative status where they will take over their child protection system. We have 2 tribes currently who have taken over their child protection system. And so we have a lot of things we're doing. And I believe, for the most part, a lot of the front end, and this is, to be clear to the committee, this is what the governor's task force focused on and what the recommendations, for the most part, focused on, was the front end of the system. When a call comes in and a report is made, what happens? And so a lot of the guidance and response that we've had is on the front end. Now we are talking about issues that, as a result of those front end changes, we have a lot of other changes happening. Caseloads have gone up, et cetera, need for foster families, all of those things have occurred. So we're moving appropriately to where needs are. At the same time, we're continuing to work on those recommendations.
Thank you.
Representative Slocum, I'm sorry.
Not as sorry as I am, Madam Chair. I'm not much on top down, but I would like to know from the frontline staff, the caseworkers, and I see a lot of green shirts out there from AFSCME, and they're my friends, and I got one of those shirts. Anyway, how do you retain your good staff? It's a burnout job. It's a hard job, and you see so much. So from the staff's perspective, from the frontline staff, and if you need to call up a couple of people, I'd be more than happy. I want to know how you retain your good staff, because I think consistency in staff is a real key in this issue.
Mr. Koppel, and I guess just so you know, the AFSCME does have time on the agenda, if that's what you're asking, to have them come forward. But if Mr. Koppel wants to address this in particular.
Madam Chair, they're talking about, all I want to know is how do you keep your staff coming back for more? You know, they're engaged and reasonably happy in a job that can really suck a person dry.
Mr. Koppel or Mr. Sorensen, who'd ever
I'll just talk briefly for a second, and then Mr. Sorensen, who has done this work in the past at a county level, so might have some insights. I would only say that the number one thing that I believe has happened over the last 2 years is recognizing the hard job that these workers do. And the first step in addressing the trauma, secondhand trauma of that work, is to know that it exists and it's there. And I can promise you that that is our priority for us, is to say, you know, in the past and for a while during this process, there was a great deal of criticism of that work because we were experiencing some bad outcomes, some horrendous outcomes. And sometimes in those reactionary phases, bad things are said or happen. And so, again, this collaborative safety model that I hope you come to the training is one of those where I really feel that frontline worker will feel so much more supported in their work than they do now. But it's going to take those types of specific, targeted, intentional actions to make a change. And I can only say we're working on it. But I'll turn to Mr. Sorensen for more specific.
I did start my career in child protection and was an investigator for a period of time, and I've spent many years, a couple decades, in this work, and it is challenging. And where the work happens is where the child welfare social worker interfaces with the children and the families. And so I think there are recommendations in the task force document that contribute and attend to retention and keeping our workforce healthy and engaged in their job. And those are, again, the ones related to a child welfare academy where people can get well-being addressed, trauma addressed, their development in terms of professional education addressed. And I also making sure that their caseloads are, close to a right size where they can do the work and have an impact. Supervisors are critically important to the wellness of our workforce and retention. There was some work done in this past year in collaboration with the Center for Advanced Studies in Child Welfare at the University of Minnesota. They did a workforce study to Minnesota's child welfare workforce. And Tracy Liliberty is here today, the executive director from CASHU, and she may be able to better speak to that specific study and the findings and some of the potential solutions, if that's of interest to you. But that work study has also assisted in us in developing a roadmap in terms of how we attend to our workforce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, you mentioned the safety training, and I was wondering where it's being held.
Madam Chair, Senator Eaton, a little out of practice here. I got to get back in it. It is on the 24th and 25th of October Is it at the same place we had the last one, in Dakota County at the, it's not the Nature Center?
Mr. Koppel, might I suggest if maybe you just want to send the information to all of the committee members
out.
And yep. send it to us, and we'll make sure. But
right.
So if there are members that are interested, and even members who maybe aren't here are interested, we can make sure you get that.
And Madam Chair, just to beat that drum again, that collaborative training is not only being offered statewide to all the counties, county workers, supervisors, but it's also we brought in judges. We're trying to bring in a whole cross-section of people to better understand the world of child protection and how we best address the challenges we face. So this model is a culture change. And if you're going to change culture, you want a lot of people to be involved in the process so that there's a certain comfort level with that. And so I'm not only interested in you attending, I'd be really interested in knowing your response and whether you think this is constructive and, the right direction, because we believe strongly it is, but, we don't want to run into that brick wall down the road or have a misunderstanding. So thank you.
Thank you.
And Senator Matthews, did you have a question or a comment? No? Okay, we thought we might. I'm trying not to miss anybody. So any further questions or discussion for Mr. Koppel or Mr. Sorensen? Mr. Koppel.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure that what I had suggested earlier was appropriate, and that would be that we try to highlight some additional changes that we've made in the document from the previous, and we can send those out to the committee. Is that...
That would be great.
So we'll do that.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. I just want to ask, are there any open recommendations, recommendations that still need action that are separate from the funding piece and the support? I very much take to heart your description about supporting the workers, which is very important, and also the a number of the, I note in that recommendation number 93, there's a number of specific proposals, and then just generally providing support for preventative programs. But are there any recommendations other than that that you'd want to highlight that still need some action by the legislature, by another agency, by DHS that aren't in the next, that aren't on the immediate horizon that we should be aware of?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair and Representative Pinto, I would prefer to send those two out in addition to that other list. There are some practice guidance and things like that that, as I mentioned earlier, we are working with some national groups to develop some additional guidance in certain areas. We really didn't have what we would call a comprehensive best practice guidance in Minnesota, and that's where we're trying to get to ultimately. And there are many things in there that are part of that. I would say we could highlight some of those as well when we talk about these changes we've made, if that's okay.
And Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing I would add, Representative Pinto, and just going back to what we did on the task force, the one piece that I was sitting on was the training piece. And in all fairness, that is one of the pieces that we haven't been able to get our hands around yet and address. One thing that I would offer up, and I think Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Koppel and Mr. Sorensen have said, is we really have to get our hands around the staff and training piece. And we can keep adding and nibbling around the edges about changes that DHS can put in front of counties. But until we get the social workers and we get them the training and some stability, that really is going to be our most important piece that I look back. I mean, that's the piece we didn't get a chance to address yet, because at the end of the day, that's our front line. And we can keep trying to give them recommendations, but if we don't have a stable force there, it's just going to be a moving target.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I don't know if this is for Representative Crescia or for the testifiers, but what are the pieces that are necessary to put that training piece in place? I understand there may be some funding, but what are the pieces that kind of are the next steps to actually make that happen, to what Representative Crescia referred to?
Representative Crescia.
I mean, there's a lot of things, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pittle, but one of the things we have to recognize is we have a workforce shortage across the board. I mean, we all sit on committees. Every single industry that comes in front of us talks about this issue. We have a people problem that we have to address. And while this one is near and dear to my heart because of where it's at, but the fact of the matter is we just have a people problem. And every community is faced with that, and so we just have to recognize that across the board, because as much as we want to help the social workers and get help there, we have nurses, we have long-term care facilities, and we can all go down the list. So, I mean, let's not stick our head in the sand and just think this is one industry. We have to solve this across the board the best we can. And frankly, the only way we're going to solve that is if we get more people in. And that's, I don't know how we can do it. I don't know how we can pass a law that says bring more workers to the state. We're just going to have to address that. It's going to be a tough issue.
Mr. Koppel.
I mean, Madam Chair, and Representative Crescia and Representative Pinto, we contracted with the Center for Advanced Studies and Child Welfare, and their report just came out the end of last week back to us, which is a report and recommendations for a training system reform. So we will share that with the committee. Many of these recommendations are what we've been talking about today and the steps that we can take in some sequence, because it doesn't all happen at once, but we can begin to build this this system. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm being told by staff that we should continue to move on, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll look forward to getting the information from you about the training and the report. Thank you. Now we do have, there is a memo in members' packets that's from Senate Council, and this does talk about the legislation that we passed in 2017. And so if we could just briefly go through that, and if there are any questions, we could answer. But I think just to review what we did do last year. Ms. Pontius, you're the one going to talk. Okay.
Madam Chair and members, we're going to do tag team on this, but okay. I'm first up. So
wonderful. Thank you.
The first deals with the right to counsel in child protection proceedings, and this is what's known as McKenna's Law. And I believe she may have testified at a task force meeting last interim. And also during the session, she was tracking this legislation. Her family had been involved in a child protection proceeding, and she didn't realize that they had, under current law, the right to counsel. So what this bill did basically was kind of build on that right and explicitly require that the child be informed that the right exists, and then to establish a process under which the right would be waived. And it applies to children who are 10 years of age or older, unless it's a case that is based solely on habitual truancy. And then Ms. White's going to take over here for the Human Services Programming Provisions.
Madam Chair, members, the next chunk of sections that were passed last year were in the Health and Human Services chapter of law. And the first requires the commissioner to design and implement a program to reduce the need for placement changes or out-of-home placements of children and youth and improve the functioning and stability of families. And in doing this, the commissioner is authorized to use federal adoption incentive funds to provide the services, which are listed in the memo. In addition, there was an appropriation to Anoka County for a family foster care pilot project. $75,000 went to Anoka County to establish and promote family foster care recruitment models. And the county is required to use the funds to increase the foster care providers through administrative simplification, non-traditional recruitment models, and family incentive options. The next is an appropriation to the White Earth Nation Band of Ojibwe Child Welfare Services. The legislature provided an additional $500,000 per year for a grant to deliver child welfare services. The next is a change in law related to individuals 18 to 21 years old who are re-entering foster care. The provision requires, instead of allows, the Social Services Agency to provide foster care for 18 to 21-year-olds to help the individual's ability to live safely and independently. And there's some eligibility requirements in doing in the individuals who will be able to re-enter foster care. The next is a change in law related to foster care liability insurance. The commissioner is given the authority to use federal reimbursement funds earned for expenditures made for premiums paid for insurance to offset foster care liability insurance premiums. The next is an appropriation for improvements to child protection and foster care permanency. The legislature appropriated an additional $19 million for the biennium for additional department staffing to improve child safety assessment, foster care, and permanency practice standards. In addition, this appropriation includes a pilot project for older minor youth who are homeless by providing oversight by the department and navigator services at the local level to coordinate services and housing to stabilize these youth. It's an appropriation. Now, some of these don't directly amend the child maltreatment chapter, but it relates to children. This is an appropriation for the safe harbor for sexually exploited youth. It appropriated money to fully implement the federal law and also provide shelter, emergency shelter, and transitional and long-term housing beds for sexually exploited youth. Kathy's next.
Madam Chair and members, then I'm up on page 3 of the handout, and this is amendments that were actually made to the Child Maltreatment Reporting Act last session, and there was nothing really significant that was enacted. Most of the changes were more conforming amendments, primarily in the area of the entity that's responsible for assessing or investigating a report when it's received. You know, under current law, it could be the local welfare agency, or if it occurs in some kind of facility, it might be the Department of Human Services or the Department of Health. And one change that was made was under current law, if it's maltreatment in a juvenile correction facility, it's the local welfare agency of the county where the facility is located. That was changed to the Department of Human Services would be responsible for investigating those reports. And there were a couple of new entities that were created in the law last year. One is prescribed pediatric extended care centers, and the other is certain license-exempt child care centers, and both of these were added in as new provisions, and so the statute was just amended to specify who would be responsible for conducting investigations for abuse occurring in those facilities. So for the pediatric extended care centers, it would be the Department of Health. And then for the license-exempt child care centers, it would be the Department of Human Services. And then there were just another number of other conforming amendments that were made to the statute, you know, in terms of the definitions, to add those references and those chapters of law. So it wasn't anything really significant in terms of any kind of a policy change in the Child Maltreatment Reporting Act. And then the other area I was going to touch on briefly, there were also amendments dealing with data sharing. And there's a current statute that allowed court services and county welfare agencies to share data on common clients under certain circumstances. But I know there were a number of stakeholders who were meeting over the interim before last session that were trying to facilitate data sharing in some way so that there'd be more communication among entities that had common clients. And what was finally enacted was kind of an abbreviated version of what had originally been proposed. It did a couple things. It allowed the county social service personnel to share certain data with schools. And it would be just kind of the minimum about one of their clients, you know, the fact that they had somebody who was in the child protection system, let's say, or within the umbrella welfare system, and then that they would hope to get some information from the school that was necessary to coordinate services. It does not actually allow anything to be released without consent, you know, parental consent for the education data, but it does set up a process to kind of facilitate getting that consent from the parents. So the welfare agency would contact the school saying, look, this family's involved in receiving services, and there would be a form then the parents would get where they would be given the option of consenting to the release of data. Because I know that was one concern, was that whether or not this should be released without consent. And then there were also changes in the definitions of program and welfare system to include Native American tribe programs that are providing a service component of the welfare system.
And the next provision was in the tax bill, and it was a new law requiring the reimbursement to counties and tribes for out-of-home placements of Indian children. And the new law requires the Commissioner of Revenue to reimburse counties for out-of-home placement costs of Indian children. The county must report the amount paid, and the Commissioner must certify that amount. And the county will receive the proportionate share of the $5 million appropriation based on the county's non-federal share of the out-of-home placement costs for Indian children, provided that county is in substantial compliance with the Indian Child Welfare Act compliance review system, which was also established in this section of law, requires the Commission of Human Services in consultation with counties and tribes to develop a system by January 1st of 2018 to review county compliance with the Indian Child Welfare Act and the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. And then on the last page, there were two provisions passed in the education chapter of law. The first is an education stability for students in foster care pilot project. The legislature appropriated $1 million for the pilot to provide incentives for school districts and county governments to develop partnership agreements and implement transportation plans to help keep foster care children enrolled in their school of origin when the student is placed in a foster care setting outside of the school's boundaries. Commissioner of Education is required to report on the pilot February 1st, 2018. And then next, change the priority for early learning scholarships. Early learning scholarships are available for high-quality early learning education programs, up to $7,500 per family. And the new language requires the commissioner to give highest priority for the scholarships to children who first have a parent under age 21 who is pursuing a high school diploma. Second, foster children who are in foster care or whose families are receiving child protective services. And the third priority is children who have experienced homelessness in the last 24 months.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions regarding that memo? Thank you very much. I appreciate the update because at the end of session, we all tend to go home and just try to get out of here as quickly as we can. So thank you very much. We will move on to the next agenda item, which is the review of 2621. And I just wanted to say a couple of things. Members have the fourth engrossment of 2621 in their packets. This is the female genital mutilation bill. And it went through the House and was passed by the House last year. The Senate was unable to deal with it. But what I was really looking for here is information regarding the bill and the mechanics of how it's going to affect the system we have in place and the mechanics of working within the child protection system we have. So I've asked House Counsel to go through the bill so that we have an understanding of the bill itself. And then we've got Michelle Zender-Fisher from Nicollet County and Jody Wentland from Hennepin County to try to explain how this would work in put into action in the systems we already have. So, and I'm sorry, we did contact Representative Franzen and Senator Housley, and neither of them were able to be here, but there are two handouts that Representative Franzen had made available, and they are in your packets. So it's a, there's one with kind of a, it's testimony in support of 2621, and then one that is a map. So those are two from Representative Franzen, thank you. And so I'd really like to keep it focused on how this is going to work within our system. So, Mr. Johnson, please go ahead. That would be wonderful.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Ben Johnson from House Research Department. I've been asked, as you said, to walk through House File 2621, the fourth engrossment, which is related to female genital mutilation, provide a very brief sort of contextual introduction, and then walk through the various provisions of the bill. The issue of female genital mutilation is one that the international community has been attempting to address for years. The World Health Organization places female genital mutilation into four categories. Three of those categories involve significant cutting, removal of parts of the female genitalia, surgical alteration, or a combination of all three. The fourth category is a catch-all provision, which includes any harmful action done for a non-medical purpose. Historically, Minnesota was one of the first states to pass a law that specifically makes it a crime to perform female genital mutilation. It's also illegal under federal law. This issue received some additional attention last year after the story of some Minnesota families who took their daughters to Michigan to have the procedure performed there. House File 2621 addresses the issue of female genital mutilation through two paths. The statute amends the criminal provision that's in current law, and it also amends provisions relating to child protection. In the bill, sections 5, 6, and 7 address the criminal provisions. Briefly, section 5 creates two new felony offenses. First, it creates a crime for any parent or guardian of a child to knowingly allow female genital mutilation of the child. Under current law, the action might be a crime under either a theory of aiding and abetting the person who actually performs the act or under the crime of child endangerment, but this change would eliminate any question about how to pursue a charge. The second change would create a new crime for female genital mutilation that falls in that fourth category that I mentioned, which is sort of the catch-all category and includes any harmful action done to the genitalia for a non-medical purpose. Under current law, minimally invasive procedures such as cutting or pricking of the genitalia are not clearly prohibited. Section 6 in the bill expressly permits peace officers to remove a child from parents' care based on evidence that female genital mutilation has been performed on the child. And Section 7 enhances the penalties to correspond to those four categories of female genital mutilation, as defined by the World Health Organization. The most serious form would result in imprisonment of up to 20 years, a fine of up to $30,000 or both. The next level would result in imprisonment of up to 10 years, a fine of $20,000 or both. And if the act fell into either of the two least invasive categories, as defined by the WHO, punishment would be imprisonment of up to 5 years, a fine of $10,000. Or both. Turning attention now to the child protection elements in the bill. At the moment, Commissioner of Health has a duty to provide education and outreach to the communities that traditionally practice female genital mutilation. Section 1 of the bill would amend that responsibility to include a requirement to inform community members of the possibility of losing custody of the child. Next, Minnesota has a strong preference, as you know, for family reunification and child protection cases. Section 2 states that cases involving female genital mutilation are in that small category of cases where a county does not need to make reasonable efforts at reunification. Section 3 of the bill would add female genital mutilation to the list of actions that can constitute the basis for a CHIPS petition. Section 4 adds the crime of allowing female genital mutilation while the child is a resident of the United States to the list of crimes that constitute egregious harm, Again, as you likely know, egregious harm is the highest category of harm in that child protection system and triggers several other actions, including a whole family assessment. Egregious harm can also form the basis for a petition to terminate parental rights, and as noted earlier, there would not be any need to take reasonable steps to reunify the family. I should highlight that this would not affect refugees or other immigrants who come to the United States if the female genital mutilation took place outside of the United States before coming here. Section 8 includes a definition of the term maltreatment, which would be in the child protection chapter. And finally, Section 9 would require mandatory reporters to report to the appropriate agency when there's a reason to believe that a child is a victim of maltreatment or was the victim of maltreatment in the previous 3 years. This change would refer to the new definition of maltreatment and replace the phrase neglected or physically or sexually abused. Those are the 9 provisions in the bill, and I can stand for any questions.
Are there questions for Mr. Johnson? Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Really quickly, current Section 1 of the bill and the language that's in law today, what is done for that education and outreach currently? Do you know how that looks in actual real-life practice?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Senator, I have only a little bit of information about that. What I understand is that there is a small amount of money used for educational materials and outreach. It's primarily focused right now, based on the language in the statute, on the providers who would theoretically be asked to perform female genital mutilation. But it is also targeted at the community, talking about the penalties to those providers who perform it.
Senator Matthews.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, referring to information that's usually available at a hospital or a clinic or something of the sort, is that what you're telling me?
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair and Senator, I don't want to say more than I know. I believe that those things that you just mentioned are included. I'm not sure if there is outreach beyond that.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Mann. Further questions? Senator, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is getting a bit into the child protection weeds, but I guess that's why we're here. So I'm not sure if Mr. Johnson will be able to answer this. But on page 17, the expanding the circumstances under which there's a mandated report from neglect or physical or sexual abuse to this broader term of maltreatment, I understand that would pull in these situations of genital mutilation. But it seems, as I'm reading this, that it would expand the circumstances that would require a mandated report broader than that to circumstances that involve a mental injury and potentially child endangerment, some other circumstances. And I'm just wondering, and again, I'm not sure if Mr. Johnson would know this, but it looks like by expanding that, it would expand it quite a bit beyond simply the situation with genital mutilation. I'm not sure if somebody can shed light on that.
Mr. Johnson, and might I just add that we've got, the Nicollet County attorney and Director of Human Services, and maybe they would be better able to address some of those issues.
And then that's just fine, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thanks.
Any further questions for Mr. Johnson, and then we'll bring up the other two testifiers. Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And if we could ask Michelle Zender-Fisher and Jody Wendland to come forward, and then you have a preview as to the questions you're going to get. So you, we'll give them a couple of minutes settle in and give their testimony, and then Representative Pinto will make sure that your question is addressed. Welcome to the task force, and please go ahead whenever you're ready, whoever would like to go first.
Madam Chair, my name is Michelle Zender-Fisher. I'm the Nicollet County attorney. I had the pleasure of serving on the governor's task force and have appeared before this body on a couple of occasions to testify on matters under consideration by this task force. It's my hope today to answer any questions you have regarding procedure and the implementation if this legislation would in fact pass. I am a member and am on the board at the MCAA, the County Attorneys Association, and that organization hasn't taken a position one way or the other on this particular statute. But it's really my hope to help frame up for those that if this legislation is passed, what's the real-world impact to children and families when we start applying this legislation, and also just to bring some context in when other county attorneys are having a conversation about this legislation, the kinds of questions that are raised by the impact of this legislation.
Please go ahead whenever unless you want to start answering questions. If you got, maybe Representative Pinto would want to repeat his question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Zender-Fisher, on page 17, there's this expanded set of circumstances where there's a mandated report. Right now, if there's reason to believe a child is being neglected or abused, whether physically or sexually, there's a mandated report. This would change that to if there's a belief that the child is a victim of maltreatment, a term that includes genital mutilation but seems to include some other things as well. And I just wonder if you could comment on what else, if anything, maybe I'm reading it wrong, but what else, if anything, that change would pull in?
Madam Chair, Representative Pinto, my understanding is that this might be part of that recodification effort that was before you earlier, is to, instead of throughout the statute utilizing whenever there's physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, or endangerment, for example, and in changing using four words to just including that term of maltreatment. One of the things as I was reviewing this legislation is with the intent to move forward with the recodification, it would be my suggestion that perhaps that part of this bill not go forward but wait for the recodification piece, because I think there's some other parts of 626-556 where use of that maltreatment term might be appropriate and might lead to less confusion if we only do that particular section.
Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that makes sense to me. I guess as I'm looking at that, it's on page 11 is the definition of maltreatment. So this may be more directed to the recodification. So we'll address that, I guess, when it shows up in session now. But it looks like, as I'm reading that it would pull in circumstances that involve mental injury and other circumstances that are not currently mandated reporting, but so it would expand that. So I guess it's just something to for us to keep an eye on. And again, I may be wrong about that, about the recodification, but it appears to be pulling that in. Looks like Ms. Zender-Fisher may want to say something.
And Ms. Wentlett, if you want to add something, Ms. Zender-Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Pinto. I believe that those provisions are already pulled in as part of what a mandated reporter or a voluntary reporter could report if they believe that a child is the victim of emotional harm. Those reports do come in already, is my understanding at this point.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I read this, it seems like this would convert that from the reporter can report to turning it into a mandated report, because it says on page 17, shall immediately report the information. In any case, it doesn't sound like this connects directly to the genital mutilation issue right now, and I understand you're suggesting the separation of the two, but that may be something to keep an eye on if there is that change. I had a separate question for Ms. Zender-Fisher as well, if that's okay, Madam Chair. But I can.
Representative Pinto, you're on a roll.
I'll go for it. And the question, it's really just a broad question. You talked about assessing the impact of this legislation regarding mutilation on children and families. And I wanted to know, I think many of us can see the advantages of this legislation, this being just a horrific procedure. I'm wondering, can you identify, are there concerns that you have regarding the impact on children and families, impact regarding child protection, if anything? I just want to make sure we're sort of going in with eyes open. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Zender-Fisher.
Madam Chair, Representative Pinto, I think the conversation has centered around recognition of the horrific nature of the act, but then how do we respond to that act? And the concern is, generally when we have egregious harm being committed against a child in the family,
that results in all of the children in the family being removed from the home because there is the fear that that harm could be perpetrated then amongst the remaining children. So the question that's raised under this circumstance is if you have a girl and three boys, the risk of harm, presumably to those three boys, is from this particular act doesn't exist. And so then what do we do with the three boys that are in the home, and how do we address those three children if we're removing the little girl? And I think Ms. Fishnick could, Ms. Wendland could address that particular issue in terms of dealing with it from a human services standpoint. But that's one of the legal questions we have, is generally we remove all children. But in this case, if we remove all children, what is the standard that we then apply if we're going to file a termination of parental rights? Again, practice is generally when we file a petition to terminate parental rights, we're addressing all children. And under case law development, we not only have to prove the statutory ground which this legislation would provide us for the egregious harm, but we also have to prove that that termination would then be in the best interests of that child and in that family. And so how do we address it for the male children in the family, for example, is one of the conversations that occurs.
Ms. Wendland, do you have anything to add on that to that question? I don't want to put you on the spot, but if there was some if there was more information you might have on that issue in particular.
Madam Chair, Representative, I concur. I think the challenge as we move forward with this in this legislation is looking at the entire family system and in a child protection response. When we're looking at our response, we are looking at the family system and the other children in the home. We're also looking at what are the intervention strategies, what are the efforts we need to make in regards to our responsibility of reasonable efforts towards reunification. And so understanding this legislation and how would we apply this legislation within that context would be work we would need to do and with our legal counsel.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I'll just close by thanking you for providing that information, to encourage you to keep doing so, because I feel like especially with an issue like this that's just so awful, this procedure, and we have such an immediate revulsion towards it, to make sure that we are taking steps that are truly keeping kids safe. And so we want to have as much input as you and your colleagues can possibly provide. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there further questions? Representative or Senator Matthews. I got to switch sides now. Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for sharing. Let me ask you a question, and I know that neither you nor I can see into the future, but as I'm hearing your answers to, like, Representative Pinto's questions, let me ask your opinion. Do you see this as just a little likely, or do you see it as very likely that were this to become law, there would be instances of having to enforce these decisions? Or is this... my hope is, from sitting here and why I was, why I've been looking at this issue, is we hope to make this a deterrent so that this never has to happen with families in the state of Minnesota. But in hearing your discussion, I'd just like to throw out, do you see it as on the scale of likelihood or probability, very least likely or very much likely that there would be enforcement measures taken?
Ms. Zender Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Matthews. I think part of that question goes to the differentiation that is in the statute of there's the CHIPS statute where we can file a CHIPS based upon a child who has been subjected to this procedure versus the termination of parental rights. The termination of parental rights based on egregious harm, as I understand the language, is prospective, where we're dealing with acts that happen after the date of enactment. But the CHIPS statute, the CHIPS portion of that, doesn't contain similar limiting language. And so then I think the question becomes, if we encounter a family where this practice has occurred, what are the expectations of the child protection system in responding to that knowledge? What is the expectation that if we have an 8-year-old where this practice happened before coming to the United States, but there are younger females in the home, what is the expectation of the child protection system to respond to that circumstance in light of how the child protection system is set up. The child protection system is set up to address a need, provide services, hopefully correct the condition that led to the petition, and then hope that human services can then be out of that family and the family can move forward in a healthy manner. If we're looking at a child that's in the home that's at risk for it, at what point will we feel comfortable closing that file, for example? And those are the issues that have been part of the conversation about how do we wrestle with this issue. From a lawyer's standpoint, I think there's other questions from a human services standpoint.
Thank you, Madam. Darling, I had that on. Okay. Okay, I'm just going out into left field for a moment. We've been genitally mutilating male babies with circumcision for many, many years, needlessly, and it's the obstetrician that does it because the pediatricians generally won't. For no medical reason, just it's kind of a cultural thing. The female genital mutilation I find appalling, but I also find the male genital mutilation rather appalling too. So how do we keep this? I mean, is it possible to keep this to just the female genital mutilation, or how does it expand to, or does it expand, or is it up for a challenge for male genital mutilation? Whoa, I stumped them.
Yeah, I think one of them is going to, you know, take a step back and let the other one volunteer. And Ms. Zender-Fisher, if you can't answer that particularly, I mean, you know, don't feel like you have to.
Madam Chair and Representative Slocum, I think the way the statute is crafted limits it to females.
It's just females.
The federal legislation limits to females. I think that conversation or that question you raised did just come up in conversation yesterday, is how do we differentiate the behavior? I'm not in a position to differentiate the practice in terms of the medical procedure or necessity. But that is a concern that has been discussed, is this statute and this practice will have an impact on the females in the family that will be different in potential practical implications than the males. And how are we going to respond to pulling only the female, the little girls out and leaving males in the home? Where are we going to place these little girls? We don't have enough foster homes the way it is, and we certainly don't have enough culturally and religiously appropriate foster homes if we're going to start pulling girls out of their homes based upon this practice. And so those are the real implications of this. And I'm going to go a step beyond a little bit in terms of additional impact on girls, is when a parent's rights have been terminated involuntary for egregious harm, that creates a presumption that parent is not appropriate parent for all future children. So if that parent has another child, it'll be on the birth match. We will get notice that parent has had another child. If that child is male, what's going to be our response? If that child is female, what is our response going to be for that female baby that we now have a presumption that parent isn't capable of parenting? What if we have a little boy born first, and 2 years later we have a little girl born? Those are the conversations we've been having about the impact potentially of this legislation, and that counties will have to face in addition to coming up with appropriate services.
Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I mean, another concern that this I think is a wide open area, to be honest with you, and it's kind of ripe for a lawsuit to define. The other thing that troubles me with this, and I don't get me wrong, I find genital mutilation, female genital mutilation, all of it across the board, pretty repulsive. But if Is this a law that just deals with female mutilation? Is this something race-based? Because it is in a country where the majority, well, we're quick to almost flipping the majority to minority, but mostly it is African-Americans who from Africa who are doing this procedure, and it's offensive to us, but yet male circumcision, which is kind of a white man thing, is okay. So is this a law that is race-based? And I think we need to think about that in this country to make this procedure, which is supposedly a religious procedure that affects the African-American community. Isn't education a smarter, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't have an answer to this, but it concerns me that it's race-based, and it targets the Somali community, you know, the African community in our country and or in our state, and that concerns me. I find the procedure, you know, devastating, but I don't know that the best answer is legislative. I mean, punishments we know don't deter. So, you know, what are we going to do here? Take a kid out of a home and, you know, whatever. I just think this, there's more thorny issues here than what we see on paper in front of us. I'm done now. I've preached.
And Representative Slocum, we were really trying to keep it to the mechanics of the issue just because it does get off into a lot of other questions, but I really wanted to understand how it affected our child support protection mechanisms that we have in place so that we understood, you know, as Ms. Zender-Fisher mentioned, you know, are there enough foster homes? If we put this in place, where are we putting the kids? Where are we, how are we dealing with the mechanics of it? So that's what I was really trying to focus on today so that I, and part of it is so that I understood it better. So, and Representative Creasy, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to both of you. I think that as we've heard the issue, and this has been championed in the House by Representative Franson and talked about by Representative Housley in the Senate, where we all agree is protecting the children is still of primary concern. We have that in statute. Making sure the child's safety is of paramount concern is something that we believe in. At least we pass it in statute. I realize that there's intricacies of this as it approaches certain populations and so forth. But as I look at this, our number one goal is how do we hold true to protecting the safety of these children? And so a couple of things as I think through this is we have to do that, and then we have to look at how we best prevent this, how we best build awareness, knowing that, I mean, you know, if this happens to a child, it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. Even though there may be cultural acceptance in some areas that come back from many, many generations, I'm sure we can all look at things that have happened in our own generations and say, I'm glad that practice is no longer there. I mean, you know, every race has practices that we're all glad have gone away. And so one of the questions, I'm just going to ask some things that hopefully you can help me through. How would we do a situation, if we take this situation aside, how would we handle a parent that is sexually abusing only one gender? Because I think through this, let's say we have a parent who just happens to be abusing just the males, or, you know, just the females. Are all the children removed? How does that? How do you walk through that, and is that similar or different?
I'm going to defer to Ms. Wentland on this one because of the practice of what we do from human services standpoint when we get a report in of sexual abuse, of what the practice and how it's approached, because I think it will help illuminate how we would respond to a case of female genital mutilation.
Ms. Wentland.
Madam Chair, Representative, in the case when sexual abuse reports are received by the agency would go out and do an investigation similar to this legislation with a focus upon the victim to determine if the incident occurred. In the context of Child Protective Services, we look at the context of the entire family. So when we were looking at the service needs and decision making, we were looking at the safety needs for children and service needs for all children in the home. And similar to Ms. Zender, as she indicated, moving forward, if our agency is making decisions around placement and bringing that forward through court and through our petition process, we're required to look at all children in the home and address safety needs. And in that same pathway, as we look towards termination of parental rights, we are looking at all children in the home, each child within their context of safety, but it's very difficult to separate two children, if there's three children, one is the victim, from that, because it's a complicated issue, sexual abuse, and so when we're looking at that lens, we will be looking at all children in the home and our intervention strategies, and ultimately some of those outcome strategies in regards to if the children remain in the care of their parents.
Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in a situation like that, let's say there is one parent that's abusing, and the other parent knows about it but didn't necessarily participate, how are they treated?
Ms. Wendland or Ms. Zender Fisher?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cresha, I think we really look at, again, assessing the response of the non-offending parent. There's a duty to protect, and the failure to protect would also result in looking at that parent's ability to protect the children going forward. And so what might factor in there might be if there's domestic abuse in the home, what services could we give the non-offending parent that might allow that non-offending parent to protect the child? So translating that into this particular issue, again, that would raise the question of, if we're going to terminate parental rights, are we going to terminate both parental rights? Are we going to terminate only one parent's parental rights? And what factors are going to be looked at? Generally, we don't only terminate parental rights on one parent. Usually it's both, barring exceptional circumstances.
Representative Cresha, you look like you want to talk, but I can't.
I mean, and I think what's so important here is we recognize this is horrible, and we recognize that we need to figure this out. But, you know, if I wish we could just fast forward to 3 years with a whole bunch of awareness and just get the education and get this out, but we're going to have to muck through this. And so, you know, and I go back and forth. That sexual situation where if somebody's abusing a child in the home, it's not a whole lot different here in a lot of cases, other than we're just going to have to work through some of these cases. So I guess my question is, what is anticipated? When I say work through these, what could we anticipate, Ms. Wendland, from resources and services that are going to be needed to get through this at the county levels?
Ms. Wendland.
Madam Chair, Representative, the proposed legislation addressed a challenging and complex issue that we need to invest in our communities to minimize the crisis from occurring. In regards to resources, first, we need early intervention and prevention resources. It's imperative that we partner with the community, and in particular, immigrants from countries that have practice of genital mutilation, to provide outreach, education, and support. The transition to a new country, learning the culture as well as the laws of this country and state, is daunting for many families. Strategies that leverage community, and in particular immigrant communities, provide an opportunity to support families and to assist them in understanding. Secondly, we would propose we need a child well-being approach. A child well-being approach frees us up to tailor a response to families' needs and the community's capacity. As we've been discussing, the traditional child protection response has specific regulatory requirements and compliance. However, our approach and ultimately outcomes are very different in a child well-being approach, with still the focus on the child being safe from harm and a place where they're in a more supportive environment. The traditional regulatory child protection response focuses upon removing children from harm. It is reactive. The biggest problem is that it can have numerous unintended consequences, as we talked about today. The circumstances around female genital mutilation illustrates this clearly. FGM is highly complex, often with underpinnings of domestic violence, similar to other child protection cases, sexual abuse, physical abuse. Traditional child protection have strong compliance and punitive elements that unintentionally further victimizes a mother or the non-offending individual who themselves may be a victim. The traditional model also increases the likelihood that the child may be placed in out-of-home care, or children may be placed in out-of-home care in an already taxed foster care system, and increasing stigma to a specific ethnic and cultural community. We know that foster care placement can be highly traumatizing for children, and in an already taxed system could result in numerous placements and limited ability to place a child in a home that's able to meet their cultural needs. Simply put, we are likely to further traumatize these girls when we remove them from their homes. We lack adequate resources, number of families in which to place them, and we have too little financial and other supports to offer these foster families. The traditional model risks setting everyone up for failure. A child well-being approach shares the same goal of wanting to remove the child from harm and place the child in a more supportive environment. However, it's done through partnering and building natural protection and supports for the child within the context of their community. A child well-being approach includes being responsible in assuring the safety and well-being of children. In addition, it allows us to take into consideration the context of immigration and the lived experience of new immigrants in our community. That includes helping provide supports and proactive interventions that builds upon the strengths of families and their community. This approach lets us invest in the community, in community service providers, and in families. Additionally, we need adequate resourcing. Additional state resources are needed to leverage better outcomes for children and families. These resources would allow counties and Minnesota to move from a reactionary, crisis-driven system to one that has adequate data and effectively utilizes data to identify root cause and ultimately improve outcomes for children and families, identification of high-risk youth and families, and provision of supports and early intervention, including housing, employment, training, chemical and mental health treatment, and other community-based services and supports, which we know are fundamental elements that can help prevent families and children from entering the child protection system. That front-end investment by the state in these resources could have a great return. It reduces trauma to all children, it improves the overall well-being of the child and their family, and it ultimately reduces the overall volume and long-term spending in child protection, which Assistant Commissioner Koppel touched on earlier this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Whitland. So what I'm hearing, and just me trying to encapsulate this conversation, I mean, this has international acclaim. I mean, this is something that we all agree is horrible. I mean, it would be labeled into sexual abuse, domestic violence. Everything you said there is absolutely right. And I don't see any other way around having to make sure we pass the legislation that treats it as such. However, what I'm hearing from you, and I think what is on our shoulders, and I hope we can do, is the same thing that has happened at the international level. We've got to get you the resources, the awareness, so that we can get into these families before this becomes that situation to prevent it, because we're going to spend the money on this one way or the other. We're either going to do it at the end of the spectrum or we're going to do it at the beginning. And I certainly hope that if we're going to go through with this as the legislature, and I think we should pass this and identify it as such. I mean, this is horrible, but we've got to get it on the front end. We've got to change people's minds and attitudes across the board. And so, I mean, that's how I see this. I've gone back and forth, had many sleepless nights over this. It's that important, but we have to do it, and we have to do it right.
Any other comments or questions from the committee? Thank you both very much for being here. I appreciate the information. And if there is follow-up that you would be willing to do, maybe put some of that in writing and give us something. Because it really is, it's something that I think we're going to continue to be looking at, and I appreciate the perspective of the mechanics of the bill. And we're going to move into public testimony now, and I apologize, I didn't control the time as well as I should have. But we are going to try to get through everybody, and we're going to start out with the 20 minutes for the Ask Me folks. And if there's any way that you can make it shorter than 20, and then we will go into those folks that signed up beforehand. And so Mr. Dwight Mitchell would be up first, and if there is any way, I know we said 3 minutes, but if you can make it as brief as possible when you do get up there, that I'd appreciate it. So. Please welcome to the committee, Please state your name for the record and go ahead. There's a handout.
There's a PowerPoint.
We can see it.
Do you guys can?
Yeah. We can see it here. And I don't know how to make it do that. Okay. Did you bring additional copies of the PowerPoint?
I did, Madam Chair.
And maybe if the public wanted it, we could make it available. Or did we did not get it in our packet. You didn't provide it beforehand?
No.
Oh,
no, Madam Chair.
Okay.
My apologies. Thank you, sir.
Please go ahead whenever you're ready and state your name for the record.
Good morning. I'm Cynthia Hassan with Ramsey County Child Protection. I'm a child protection screener.
John Sundell. I am a child protection worker in St. Louis County. I do safety planning. I work in the initial intervention unit.
And Mr. Sundell, you're going to have to pull the microphone a little closer when you start talking. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Ethan Vogel. I work as a legislative representative for AFSCME Council 5. AFSCME Council 5 is a union of over 40,000 workers in Minnesota, and we represent child protection workers in Minnesota's largest counties, both by population and geographic area. The challenges that are faced by our workers in these different areas are unique day to day, month to month, and case by case, but there is one thread of similarity between all of it. We have heard from many of our members, and every single person I've talked to who does this work says that their caseloads are far too high right now, and they live with a constant fear that someday one of their children will slip through the cracks, that they'll miss something, and a kid will be seriously injured or, at the worst case, will die. And we know we can't eliminate this fear, but what we are hearing from our members is that it is far too likely that something terrible will happen, and we owe it to them and the children of this state to listen to the workers.
So in the task force and the recommendations, one of the recommendations was, of course, the caseload sizes. And so as a child protection screener, it's become very evident that in a very short period of time, our caseloads have grown enormously. They've doubled. Unfortunately, we don't have the ability, as other speakers have mentioned, to double our workers, the number of workers that we have. As a matter of fact, it's becoming increasingly more difficult to maintain and retain the workers that we have. And in Ramsey County specifically, child protection workers make 8% more. That's in the interest of keeping people in the work. And we've had large numbers of experienced veteran workers who have demoted themselves, taken lower-paying jobs because the caseloads are so unmanageable. And that's frightening for us.
So to continue on that, as everyone knows, there was $52 million that were basically assigned to the child protection work that we do. Unfortunately, our workloads are heavier and there are less children that are safe in the opinion of most of us. We're basically burden, you know, and I can echo the same thing she had said about her county. Our workers are, they're all leaving. They don't want to be there. They can't be there because of the work. We essentially, we're burdening the system even more, and we have less prepared systems now that are in place to handle the overburden. So, thank you, Senator Fishback and Representative Carisha. We want to be here and we want to be a resource for you guys during this process. It's really imperative that we are having essentially a seat at the table. Obviously, we're not elected officials, but we really want to be a part of this process now and in the future.
So in thinking about some of the unintended consequences of the recommendations, you can't possibly anticipate how the workload increased. And so child protection workers are spending enormous amounts of time doing paperwork
they're spending two-thirds amount of their time doing paperwork and work on the computer and so on, and about one-third of their time in actually doing the casework with the families. So in thinking about resources and rethinking resources, in spite of the fact that there was $52 million appropriated to address this increase in the workload, we've expanded things such as the 24/7 screening now. So we were doing 40 hours worth of work, and now for many counties that have not had access to additional dollars for the 24/7 screening, we're now thinning out the number of workers, having the same number of workers cover 168 hours of work. So we had six screeners, for instance, in Ramsey County working 40 hours a week, and now we have six screeners plus a couple of part-time workers that are covering 24/7 with a very, very thin, fragile plan for how do you cover for vacations, how do you cover for sick, and so on. So in spite of the fact that we want to be able to meet the changes that the task force recommended, we're really struggling with making that happen, and it's been incredibly stressful. In terms of the number of cases that caseworkers are supposed to have, the reality is, in spite of the recommendation of being 10, many workers have 30 and 35 cases. Again, as John said, you can't in good conscience talk about losing sleep at night, worrying about children. Workers are having incredible levels of stress in their lives, and many of them are making that tough choice then to completely leave a profession that they have a great deal of passion about and have worked in for many, many years.
So currently there isn't a standard that has been set by DHS regarding caseloads for investigators, people that are doing the assessments, or for the screeners. We want you guys as a task force to ask DHS to make that recommendation. I know it's one of them from the 93, but that's still not there yet, as we're aware of anyways. That needs to be out there to kind of let us move forward and understand what that needs to look like at our level.
I kind of already touched on the difficulty in retaining our staff, hiring new staff, and I was really happy to hear the Assistant Commissioner Koppel talk about the new training, because I've heard a lot of good things about it too. There are a number of people in my county that have attended that training on safety, and I think the effort that can be put into switching the culture will also help retain staff. Because if we feel like, in spite of the heavy workload, every little error that occurs, because we're not perfect, we're going to continue to make mistakes. But if we don't feel like we have the support of our superiors, why would you want to keep in it? Why would you want to keep doing that?
So to kind of add on, with our amount of caseloads that we have, thanks. So the amount of cases that we have, there's also, when we're pulling numbers and we're assessing what do the workers have, where is everybody at, there's a large volume of new workers that have been hired, which could be viewed as a good thing. I think it is overall once you get them up and running. However, when we're assessing what true caseloads are and true numbers, I'm just telling you, any worker in our building in St. Louis County that has cases that has been there for more than 6 months, probably even three, they have way more cases than they should have. The seasoned workers are at 40, 50, 60 cases. When I transitioned from IIU to safety planning, I think my last number was 61 cases. We're getting destroyed. So please take that into consideration when you're breaking down the numbers on who has what. Oh gosh, there's this many workers. The average caseload is 12. It's not. It's not 12. We would like to see, just kind of move forward onto the training that we're just talking about, we want to see expanded safety planning to bring families together to make decisions.
Let's go to higher case aids.
Which one is that?
Well, we were kind of touching on trying to be more creative in the staffing, too. So having more support for the child protection workers, such as utilizing case aids to do some of the tasks that we do, such as transporting children to and from appointments, making sure they're at school, getting parents to appointments and so on, and also providing us with adequate clerical support so that we aren't in front of the computer screen all the time, that we can be out there doing those face-to-face with families.
So we would like to see training expand. We want to see more safety planning. We want to bring families together and make decisions about how to care for the children and develop a plan, as it says up there on the slide. So currently my role in St. Louis County is I'm a safety planner, and I do just that. Unfortunately, across the state, there's not a lot of us. There's a grant-funded portion out there for family group decision-making is probably what most of you are familiar with. This job is really important. It can bring families together, bring the communities together. It can really hone in on the families who are the experts, get them to the table, and it can improve our standing with the community, with each other, with the children and the families, and most importantly, keep kids out of placement. And so if we can do that, if we can intervene up front, which is what we're starting to do in our county. We've done it for 5 to 10 years in our county. We've been implementing that instead of focusing on the end of when the kids are done in their placements and we're trying to fit them back into their home. We can invest that money up front into that type of approach. We could jump in, work better with the families, have them as the experts, like I said, and then we would be saving money across the board. We'd be able to reduce the court placements. We'd be able to reduce the long-term caseloads. So, we would like investment in our we got thrown off. We skipped a slide earlier.
Which one you
want
to go with?
Pick one. So we would like to really jump into what those trainings look like. There's a lot of them out there. A lot of trainings we have right now are focused on core training. A lot of the funding is focused on that. And we want to see funding jumping into other things as well to give us the skills and the abilities to work with the children and the families. Versus learning how to use my computer, learning how to work with a system that I don't necessarily need to know the whole thing of. Core training focuses a lot on that. It takes up about 11, 12 full work days for a worker in their first full year. So we're investing all this money and time into something that would be helpful to learn. However, why aren't we giving workers skills to work with the families that they're supposed to be working with? So we want to see more of that.
So in thinking about when staff are responding to children who need, say, for instance, a report of egregious harm where we have to establish an immediate safety plan, oftentimes that includes removing children. So what we're faced with in child protection, believe it or not, are sometimes children are taken into care and we have no place to put them, and children have ended up sleeping on cots in our offices overnight, so that staff have to be on call to be in the office to supervise those children, come up with food, change their diapers, tend to whatever their needs are. Locally, we've also had children taken into care, and in Ramsey County, children that are under age 12 always go in for a medical exam as well before they are placed into shelter, and if there's no shelter space, those children are sometimes spending multiple days in the exam room of an emergency room, also under the care and supervision of a child protection worker who, through on a rotating shift, are going down to the emergency department and sitting with the child in an exam room. And if you haven't ever been in an exam room of an emergency department, it is very small. It is not meant to be temporarily housing anybody. It's meant to give emergency care, but we have absolutely no other choices. So the number of resources that we have for caring for children is in really desperate need. So focusing some urgent attention on our ability to recruit and maintain and support foster providers is really at a critical level. I'm not exaggerating when I'm talking about children being in the emergency room or children sleeping on cots in offices. It hasn't just happened once or twice. It happens on a regular basis.
So we would like you guys to repeal Subdivision 3 of Minnesota Statutes 256M.41. You guys probably all know this, that basically is taking money away from us as child protection workers to do our job. So 80% of that is given to us as a county entity, and then the 20% is given to us upon our performance of meeting those timelines, making those contacts. It spreads very in what your job is. Please don't punish us for not being able to get the job done that we've already been trying to do. So this would be really, really important to get money that's already out there, that's labeled for us, and not consequence us before we even start to get the job done. So we would like to see more support out there. Foster parents currently, and I know there's legislation that's going out to try to help with this, but we can't get foster homes to take little kids. They have to pay more money than they're getting for providing foster care to put the child in daycare. Most of our foster parents are different these days than they were 20 years ago. Most of our homes, both parents are working. If there are two parents, if there's one parent, most of them are working. So during the day, they have to find foster, or they have to find daycare. That's just, it's a complete shift, and it's really difficult to find people to be able to take these babies in, or young children. It's creating a barrier to recruit them and to retain them as well.
And then finally, a big concern is that when we're working with families, the overwhelming majority of them, huge barriers for mental health and chemical health services, so that families, regardless of the intervention of child protection, if we're not able to refer them to or allow families to have access to adequate mental health services and chemical health services, they're never going to be set on the path to recovery so that they can safely meet the minimal needs of their children.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, for the sake of time, we'll skip the last slide, but I do have a story about what a successful case management can look like. So I'll hand that out, and we'll yield the rest of our time to other testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question, if you could help flesh out what you mean by driving your clients to appointments. What does that look like? Is that the children? Is that the parents?
Both.
Where are they driving? Can you
So a child might have a medical appointment for some follow-up on a particular issue that they have, medical issue that they have. Child protection, if they're in our care, we're responsible for arranging for their transportation, whether it's the child protection worker taking them to that appointment, a case aide taking them to that appointment, or a parent. If part of our recommendation is that they have some unmet mental health needs, we will assist the parent in making that appointment for psychiatry. If they have difficulty in getting there, or we want to make sure that they do get there, then we're going to go pick them up and take them. So workers, many of our child protection workers have to park 4 and 5 blocks away, so they have to go and get their car, go get 3 or 4 car seats, put them in their car. You can imagine multiple times a day, that's how they're spending their time.
Just to kind of add to that as well, it would be a lot more cost effective, and we would be able to do the other parts of our jobs more effectively and have more time if we were able to utilize something more like a case aide for duties like that. Earlier you're talking about kids sitting in the emergency room, or in our county we had kids on cots all night long because the shelter wouldn't take them, and there was five of them, and we had one staff person sitting in there with them all night, and then the next day people sitting there with the kids all day. This is like a normal, not the overnight thing, but we have kids in our office all the time that we're working with, that we're trying to work through these difficult things with. We need more people. Whatever that looks like, I guess, is up to you folks, but that would be a way to save money if we could have someone or more people in case aid positions.
And I would like to move on because we do have quite a few testifiers today, and so I'd like to be able to hear everybody. But thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We've got the handout, and if there is anybody who has questions, follow up with one of the testifiers would be something we could do. We'll start out, and I know we did say 3 minutes, but if you can limit it the best you can. There's Mr. Dwight Mitchell signed up. Please come to the testifying table and just state your name. And my understanding is you had a handout, and it's being handed out to the committee right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dwight Mitchell. I'm from Piscataway, New Jersey. I was living temporarily in Apple Valley, Minnesota, when I became involved with CPS. Senators, members of the Assembly, why am I here? I don't have to be here. I'm from Jersey. I'm 57 years old and lived almost my whole life in New Jersey. So then, why am I here? I paid for my expenses to be here and took time out of my life to be here for all the parents who can't be here. All the parents who have had their children taken who shouldn't have and can't get them back because they don't have the financial or other means to deal with the system. That's why I'm here. I can be here today and smile, and I can be here today and be happy. Why can I be happy at a hearing on such a serious matter as child abuse and loss of parental rights? Because I got my children back. I got my children back. I can smile and be happy because I got my children back. But there are many people who wrongfully had their children taken from them who are not able to smile or be happy because they don't have their children back. So today I'm going to tell you what happened to me and why it shouldn't happen to anyone else, and what I think should be done to change the system to be able to ensure that a parent never goes through what I went through and can get their children back, so that that parent also can someday again smile and be happy. I believe the recommendation previously sent to you in my letter of September 11, 2017 will help ensure that, and I welcome the opportunity for further discussion. I work as an international management consultant for some of the top companies in the world, and I was working here in Minnesota for CHS when I lost custody of my youngest son for 5 months when he was 6 years old, and my middle son, who was 10 years old, for 22 months. At the time I was dragged into the problem later Minnesota Child Protective Service, I was 54 years old and had no criminal record. I spanked my 10-year-old son on the behind for stealing and lying about it after we returned from a children's party. I am fully aware there are children who do need to be moved from wretched situations and need protection. My concern is with children and parents caught up in what amounts to legal kidnapping. In my particular case, there were many Minnesota state statutes that Tocolo County did not follow, and if they had, I would have had my children back in 60 days instead of 22 months. Dakota County chose to ignore the laws that you, the legislature, made, even when notified of those laws. Dakota County and state officials fabricated evidence, withheld exculpatory evidence, lied, and went about their illegal activities with a brazen arrogance. totally without fear of reprimand, reprisal, or the consequences of their illegal actions. There is a total and complete lack of oversight and accountability at DHS from the top down. I am here for everyone in this situation. While this taking of our children has hit African-American families disproportionately, I am here today for all American families. Unless you've been targeted by child protection services, you cannot even begin to imagine the feelings of pain, grief, financial loss, helplessness, and the depression caused by having your children removed without due process and the nightmare involved in getting out. No horror movie could ever prepare you for this. My case is not isolated. This is happening all over the United States. If any of you have children, just think about that. 22 months of no contact whatsoever, no phone calls, no visits, no letters, nothing. 22 months of lost smiles, lost hugs, and lost time spent together as a family. Almost 2 years of not seeing or hearing from your child. Not even being told where he was. Every night, not knowing where he was. The same feeling as every parent's worst nightmare. Kidnapping.
Mr. Mitchell, I appreciate the information. I am just wondering if you could get to maybe some of the recommendations because I noticed you had a few things here specific to a bill, and if you could get to those recommendations fairly quickly, that would be helpful.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
And I just because I want there are so many people who are signed up today that I just and I appreciate the representative senator's time. So
I apologize, Madam Chair. To be succinct, one of the key things, since I'm from New Jersey has had the difficulty that Minnesota has had. There are a lot of lessons to be learned from New Jersey. They've been under federal oversight for 10 years and have made great strides. If you look at the percentages of decline, you'll see that it's been significant. One of the key things that I wanted to point to was statute 609.337, malicious punishment of a child. I wanted you to make that language congruent to the language what you had for 6 years old. So you had language in one side as it relates to malicious punishment of a child and an age criteria, but that wasn't reflected in 609.337. In my particular case, for a spanking, I was held under one statute for a 10-year-old son, and I was just hoping you could make that congruent. Something else that I think I've heard a lot about today was talking about the increase of children in service. Something that happened to me was that didn't happen was a safety plan. I would like to recommend that the safety plan for a first-time offender be mandatory, a mandatory 60-day safety plan enacted. If something of that nature would have happened in my case, instead of my sons being removed for a spanking and being withheld in the system for 22 months, they would have remained in the home. If you would have told me, Mr. Mitchell, you can't spank your children anymore, we're going to put in a safety plan and monitor you for 60 days, well, that would have alleviated 22 months of foster care and things of that nature. So I think that's something you should consider also. I'm going to yield the floor. One of the key things in my case, I see you put additional language in your bill for immunity. You've actually increased the immunity. And I put in language in my recommendations. Hopefully you can adopt Arizona's language for immunity. And I wanted you to consider that. It's going into effect in 2017. It's called Employee Misconduct and Violations. The 10th Circuit has recently put in place language to affect immunity.
And, Mr. Mitchell, I'm going to have to cut you off, and I really do appreciate it. And we do have the information that you handed out. So, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Ms. Kane. And then just so that you know, next up, we have Mr. Gehrman. So if you could be ready, there you are.
Please, my name is April Kane. Thank you, Madam Chair and Chairpersons and members. I worked for 5 years in Minnesota for Aaron's Law, which is a law that would teach children in Minnesota personal body safety. This is not sex education. It passed this session as an option with no funding, but it would help us greatly in Minnesota. It teaches children if they're wearing a bathing suit, that part of their body is private, and if someone is trying to touch them in a private area, they should tell a trusted adult. If someone is asking them to touch them in a private area, they should tell a trusted adult. And if someone is telling them to keep that secret, it is an unsafe secret, and they should tell a trusted adult. Currently, 9 out of 10 children do not tell when they are sexually abused. I never told until I was 53 years old. 9 out of 10 are sexually abused by someone they know. Minnesota spends $8 billion a year dealing with sexual violence, and Minnesota spends $560 million a year because we do not effectively prevent the sexual abuse of children. If we taught personal body safety to children in the schools for 1 hour a year, which is Aaron's Law, we could help all the people that have testified today, DHS, Assistant Commissioner Capital, female genital mutilation, because children would disclose abuse because currently they do not know it's reportable and wrong. I was raped when I was 6 years old in the laundry room of my building. When I went up to speak to my mother, she knew I was upset, but I had not been taught any vocabulary to describe rape, sodomy, abuse, and she simply said, "You are not allowed in the laundry room anymore." I received no medical help, no mental health, nothing. We can do better for our children. We are one of only 3 states in the entire country that has not passed or introduced a law to require our children to be taught in the schools personal body safety. We can help so many children if we do this, but to not do it is cruel, is unimaginable. The scars are lifelong. And although we have Aaron's Law that is optional, it is not enough. And I ask you to put Aaron's Law on the agenda for the next meeting. I ask any legislators who are willing to please introduce a law to make personal body safety in Minnesota required. We are one of only 3 states who are not trying to do this. We need to address the sexual exploitation of children. In addition, we have some of the weakest sentencing for sex offenders in the country. We know that 90% of the people in Minnesota picked up for child pornography never see 1 day in state prison. It's catch and release in Minnesota. I have seen people picked up on sexual abuse for a third offense and set free. We know there are so many loopholes. We have 500 invisible sexual predators who got a stay of adjudication who could live next door to you. Recently, an 8-year-old boy was killed trying to protect a 7-year-old sister from a sexual predator. An 8-year-old boy is doing the work that we should do, but we're not, and we can do better. The children need to know that sexual abuse is reportable and wrong. They don't know unless we teach them. I testified 9 times last session, and people came up to me, many from the Somalian community, and they said, "Thank you for testifying, and in our community, we are not even allowed to say the word sex. How can we report sexual abuse when we can't even say sex?" Teaching personal body safety in Minnesota would help all the children, and in addition, would help prevent female genital mutilation. I have been doing this for 5 years, and I greatly appreciate the chief authors, Representative Bennett and Ingrid Betson, and the co-authors who passed Aaron's Law as mandatory, but I believe we need to do better. We need to have it to be required, to allow children to be raped and sodomized and have no help and not even know that's reportable and wrong is atrocious. And we have to do better, and we can. And I ask you to help in any way that you can by contacting those in the audience, by contacting your legislators to ask to move Aaron's Law as mandatory, and for those on this committee to be willing to put it on the agenda and speak about it. And I greatly appreciate your help, and I appreciate the time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Gehrman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the task force. I'm Rich Gehrman. I'm the Director of Safe Passage for Children, and we're a citizens advocacy group and also a member of the Governor's Task Force on Child Protection. First, let me say that you are the primary accountability mechanism for ensuring that the reforms that were passed in 2015 or recommended are actually put into practice. So we thank you for your continued commitment, and we will support you in continuing to stay the course. I just want to make two brief points this morning. First, the caseload increases that were discussed early are absolutely the intended consequence of the statute change that required counties to respond uniformly to reports of child maltreatment. And the reason for that statute was, as many of you recall, that counties previously only screened in or responded to about 28% of maltreatment reports. And that's compared to an average nationally for states of 62%. So that translates to about 14,000 children a year who would have received some kind of visit from a child protection worker in most states who weren't getting that visit in Minnesota. Today, our best estimate is that counties are screening in approximately 43% of maltreatment reports, and that means about 14,000 more children a year are getting an appropriate child protection response. And even if we should be screening in more like 62%, we're moving in the right direction, and that's good. However, as you've heard, responding to these reports means more open child protection cases and foster care cases, and that we need to get caseloads down to a manageable size. We understand the budget implications, but please let me recall that in Minnesota, the state only contributes about 24% of the cost of child protection and foster care, again, compared to most states nationally that contribute over 60%. So this places a huge burden on counties. And it's pretty clear that unless the state does step up and pick up more of the cost of these programs, that we're not going to be able to successfully make the improvements we all want in child protection and foster care. So that's one area. The second area to touch on briefly is in the governor's task force, we spent a great deal of time on practices in family assessment. Some of those have been addressed by the department's new guidelines and best practices, but there's still a core set of practices in family assessment that we think continue to put children in danger and are a problem with child safety and well-being. They're all around a set of practices that allow the adults in a household an opportunity to coach and intimidate children before the child protection worker gets a chance to talk with them. So, as many of you know, it's a standard practice in family assessment. As far as we know, it continues to be the practice to interview children as the first step in the process in the presence of their alleged abuser. So you can rest assured none of your constituents thinks that makes sense because I talk with them a lot. This goes along with things like giving advance notice that the worker's coming out, not interviewing the child separately from the adults, and assigning a risk to the case, whether it's family assessment or investigation, before any fact-finding is done. So we think that this may be changing, but all the information we have is that counties in the state don't intend to change this. They prefer the old practices, and if that continues to be the case, this is something we'd like to bring forward in potential legislation. If I can make one more point, I had
one real
intended.
Brief.
Very briefly, I just want to reinforce the AFSCME testimony about how much time is spent in dealing with the computer system, the paperwork, and there are some ways to deal with that that I'd like to talk with people about at some point, but I think every hour we can save and that paperwork goes directly to the bottom line and is more time for casework, and I think we could cut that from two-thirds to, you know, by 20 or 30% easily. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I have Julie Shordahl, and I guess Gregory Van Leer is from the same organization, so if you'd like to come up together quickly. Thank you. Please just state your name for the record and
great.
Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members for having us here today. My name is Julie Shordahl. I'm the CEO of St. David's Center, which is a children and family service organization, a nonprofit serving over 3,000 children and their families annually across the Twin Cities metro. Our services include intervention and treatment programs for children facing challenges, developmental challenges and otherwise, including children who have faced trauma. I'm here today to share with you our perspective from being in the trenches on this work, on issues of concern in the child welfare system, and specifically to tell you about an initiative in which private foster care agencies, including St. David's Center, are banding together to give voice and move forward with critically needed systems change. I'm here also to invite you to a launch of our initiative that is taking place later this month. So as those governing and developing policies for our state, there, you know there are not easy answers to complex community-wide problems. So we're best to not think that just regulation and policy change or trainings will dramatically change as change the system as important as those changes, initiatives are. We must step back together and have good community-led conversations, listen and learn from one another, and then as a community, build into the system new ways to address the problem. At St. David's Center, we learned about a nonprofit organization leading this kind of system change, gaining ground across the nation. Its title is the Youth Law Center, and their mission is to protect the children in the nation's foster care and justice systems from abuse and neglect, and to ensure they receive the necessary support and services to become healthy and productive adults. They've started an initiative called the Quality Parenting Initiative, QPI. The QPI initiative is an approach to strengthen foster care. It's a process to help sites across the nation develop strategies and practices. Their core premise is that the primary goal of the child welfare system is to ensure that children have effective and loving parenting. Unfortunately, that is not always the case consistently in our system. So what we've done with the help of Aspire Minnesota is that we've banded together as private nonprofit organizations and are bringing the QPI initiative to Minnesota. 13 organizations are all in without any additional funding. Each organization has put funding in a pool, and we're bringing the QPI initiative to Minnesota and to embark on the process of stepping back, learning, discussing, listening, and ultimately creating new ways together. We're inviting everyone into this community conversation. Agencies overseeing the state work, Marvin Davis is very supportive of this project, counties, private agencies, but most importantly, the youth in the system, foster parents, and birth families. We're doing this initiative starting with a launch at the end of October. It seems October 24th is a popular date. Assistant Commissioner Koppel mentioned the training that they're having on October 24th. We're also launching a three-day set of meetings with the whole set of stakeholders across Minnesota, across the 13 agencies, including many foster parents and youth. And we'd like to invite you. My ask is pretty simple. I want you to know about this initiative that's taking place that's just being community-led by this set of private agencies in the foster care system. And I want to invite you to join us for that first day launch. Perhaps you might think about dividing your committee and going to both the training and joining us for our launch at the Wellstone Center in St. Paul at 9 a.m. on the 24th of October. We'll send you information about it, and I thank you for listening, and listen as we continue to go forward with this initiative.
Thank you very much, Mr. Van Leer.
Madam Chairman, my name is Gregory R. Van Leer, Sr. I've been married for about 40 years to my wife. We've had been licensed in Washington County, and also I'm currently licensed with St. David Foundation. We've had over 70 kids come through our house in various forms of foster care, and we've seen some of the good, the bad, and the ugly practices with foster parenting and also some of the county workers as well. The people have changed. The systems have been tweaked, but the results, especially for children of color, have not changed much and many times have exacerbated an already tenuous situation concerning birth parents and children and the intended saviors, the county workers, who are often looked upon as the enemy. I recognize that the stalwart mindset of tradition can stymie any new approach to an old problem, and that often it's the existing pillars of authority and leadership that has to change to implement new ideas. Hence, we must be bold enough to admit that something is not working and look outside the defined boundaries of our experience and knowledge for methods of securing the results that we have not been able to achieve or sustain. I believe that the Quality Parenting Initiative, QPI, will give the people of our counties and states more tools to help families and communities assist in mitigating the reoccurring issues of multiple placements of the same child. To back up my assertion, I'll give you a couple of instances. While in Washington County, we had a sibling group of four kids from 11 years old to 9 months coming to our fostering home, which lasted for about 9 months. These children went back home, and in my wife's opinion, that mother was not ready to receive those children. In less than a month, they were back at my door one evening, unannounced, asked us to take those kids back. After a year in our home, they were adopted. That mother received no ongoing support service to help prepare her for proper parenting of her kids. When you have several generations of inappropriate parenting, you get where we are today. Kids who are damaged psychologically and emotionally by households that are not conducive to nurturing children. Now, let me give you the good side. We had a young man in my home here recently who was about 11 years old who came into the therapeutic foster care organ system through St. David Foundation. He had been institutionalized for a year, had underlying emotional, mental, and learning disabilities that contributed to his situation. The birth mom had over the years not provided the early love and support that a child needs in those critical development years. The red flags that neither the mom, the red flag was that neither the mom had any of these real nurturing services when she was growing up. So the pattern just continues itself. So without going to the facts of the case, he was removed from her care and placed in a home of the biological father. This led to disciplining the child in only way that he knew, which is what he learned in his home environment growing up. And but due to some behavior issues, that child was moved to a residential care center. That's when we came in, St. David's Therapeutic Foster Care Oregon program, was providing him an opportunity to come out of that program and enter our home. And in our model, the parents and family members simultaneously receive therapy and counseling along with the child. Whereas mom recognized the deficiency in her son and was eager to help and support, dad resisted. The county was the enemy. And I was the foster parent, and we know how foster parents are looked at. After about 2 months, dad finally began to participate in the therapy sessions. It was during one of the combined family therapy sessions that dad had an epiphany of sorts, where he could see that everyone that was around the table was for him and not against him. His son was making progress in the program, and if anything, his reluctance to fully engage has slowed his son's progress. I'm just about done.
I'm
at the end of my page.
Mr. Van Leer, I'm sorry. We've got so many people to testify. Two more. 30 seconds.
30 seconds. While I'm happy to report that this placement ended well, the young man transitioned into care of another relative. But today he is spending the bulk of his time with his father, and I have a continuing relationship with that family. While we're not using the QPI model directly, we use elements of it, and I believe it's responsible for that son's outcome, that there's realization that we were all there for him and not against him.
Thank you very much. We next have Dr. Hollensteiner, and just so we know, next up would be Ristel Pun. Am I getting that right? So you'd be next. So if you'd like to come and stay at the table, well, Dr. Hollensteiner goes ahead, but please go ahead whenever you're ready.
Members of the task force. I'm Dr. Lisa Hollensteiner. I was on the governor's task force, and I'm an emergency department physician. Thank you for your commitment and continued work toward implementation of the task force recommendations. Many recommendations have been implemented thanks to you and to DHS. There are still many recommendations that have not been implemented, and I'm here to note a few. I know you asked about three things you could do going forward, and here are three suggestions to start. First is substantial child endangerment. That's number 16. On the implementation documents, it's either said it's completed or mostly completed, which is not accurate, as they haven't been incorporated into statute, or there have been what I believe are innocent misunderstandings that they have overlooked our minor change in words, such as one example would be where we said substantial child endangerment would be withholding life-saving treatment from an infant, and we thought that should be a child because it should be a child of any age, not just an infant. And so I'm not sure where to direct this so that someone on your end understands this, but essentially, bottom line, number 16 still needs to be implemented legislatively, and Senator Sharon did draw up a bill. There were multiple meetings with multiple stakeholders, and that still needs to be looked at. Secondly is data. Chief Justice Blatz was a great proponent of data and increased transparency to allow continued evaluation and promote transparency. If I were one of you, I'd want to know the data in a timely manner. So three basic things, such as number of child protection reports, what percent are screened in, what percent go to family assessment versus investigation. Currently, you're only getting this annually, and there's a lag. All you have right now is the 2015 data. DHS has added many things to their dashboard, but I think many of us feel, that these numbers could be added quarterly by county so that any of you could look in 2017 and see how many child protection reports were there versus last quarter, and what our screen-in rate is, rather than having a year-and-a-half lag for you all to look at and try and make administrative decisions. And then finally, mortality review. The process has been revised, but the recommendation was for increased public transparency, for information such as the cause and circumstances, prior reports of child abuse and prior investigations, and what services were provided. Again, strongly put forth by Chief Justice Blatt, as she thought that there should be accountability and opportunity for change. We aren't doing this at all right now. Wisconsin has a public dashboard where they do share this type of information, and so it can be done. I hope that you'll address at least these three things in the coming year about substantial child endangerment, data, and mortality review. I know you asked about what else you could do. There was a report from the last legislative task force with a long list of things that still needed to be addressed, and I know that implementation document is always daunting, but it seems like it would make sense to have a list of what legislatively still needs to be changed because there are a multitude of issues that still could be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ristel Pun, am I pronouncing that correctly, please?
Yes.
And then I guess on the, I have Mr. Baker would be next.
Thank you for allowing me to speak. My child was removed from me based on false charges. I was violently arrested and held in jail for 4 days. The charge was dismissed. This child actually had been left with me when he was 6 months old, and I had worked with Ramsey County and Child Protection there. And Ramsey County stated and recommended that this child stay in my care. So in 2014, when my son was the age of 10, Hennepin County had said that I was insignificant in this child's life. During the past 10 years, I had spoke and met with three different welfare child protection workers in three different counties because the ball was bounced back and forth. I made police reports. I talked to attorneys. And everybody just kind of came up with, this is a private matter. Handle it on your own. I have not, at this point, been allowed to present anything about my case in court. Three and a half years later, I was effectively stonewalled from ever making a presence in court. Now, I do have my child back home. It took me well over 2 years to do so. And during those 2 years, what myself and my family endured, it's unbelievable. And all of it, everything that was done, was void of any lawful procedure. I know in the past when somebody said, well, they're going dealing with child protection, in the inside, I know even I thought, well, they must have done something. After 8 months of having my child in custody, I finally received a case plan that involved extreme sleep deprivation, and I was doing two sets of UAs every day for a year and a half, and I do not have a drug history, only to realize that my case plan was basically a ruse. It was a placebo. The caseworker never followed up and to check to see if any of it was done successfully, any of that type of that nature. That my social worker was so removed from what myself and my family were going through that when she came to the visit, to her 30-minute visit with me, she showed up dressed to the nines and driving a Mercedes-Benz. During the visit, she pursed her lips, kept rolling her eyes, and looking off into the distance. I submitted a background check. After 8 months, that background check had not come back, and I was suspecting that there was no background check that was submitted. I was told one afternoon that if this background check didn't show up by the morning, my child would be adopted out to the foster parents. From the afternoon to the morning, what are the chances of me tracking down that background check? I called the FBI. No background check had ever been submitted as required by law. I had lived out of state for a couple of years, so I called Arizona. No background check was submitted to them either. I managed to get one faxed over and to the courts by the morning. I kept hearing things like, oh, I'm sure this wasn't done maliciously, and they're not organized, and they have heavy caseloads. But I don't know of any other job where lack of organization, heavy caseloads, is a reason for not doing your job properly or following the law. DHS didn't put their own charge on me. I'm currently fighting that. Everything was done neglectfully and blatantly. Almost all my proof comes from within their own records. This indicates to me that these are systems that they're used to doing, and they do it right in front of everybody. The county attorney has offered me a deal where they will rescind the charges, but I can't use that information moving forward in the courtroom. I can't do this.
Ma'am, if you could wrap up.
Okay, I will. Time. I will just say that I think that heavy caseloads and that can be brought down. If the child protection cases were cases that had substantial evidence, had any evidence, solid evidence, I would say that I hear a lot of standard practice, but what I'm presenting to you also is standard practice. What's happening, largely to minorities and lower income families, is happening to a lot of people.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have, and I wish I could pronounce the first name. It's I'll just spell it. K-I-Y-A-N-U, Baker.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you very much. And while they're settling at the table, I have found out that the vice chair has to be gone by 12:45, and we are over our time anyway. So, but has to be on the road by 12:45. There is a group of folks who signed up. If there would be want to be, we probably have time. If one person wanted to come forward, I know that they were. It looks like they're from from the same group. Otherwise, they will be given preferential treatment from for the next meeting, which will probably be the second week in January. So, because we're getting through everyone who signed up ahead of time, and these are the groups that signed up today. So, if there was maybe one person that they would like to send forward after this, after Mr. Baker, that may be the way we handle. Otherwise, at the next committee meeting, at the next task force meeting, they would be put on the list. So let us know if there would be one person you'd want to send forward, and please proceed. And just identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Jennifer Quinn, and this is my son, Keanu Baker. And he wrote a speech for today, but he's too nervous, so if that's okay, I'm going to read it for him.
And that's fine, and if you have it in writing, we can make, you can submit it, and we can, oh, you have it on iPad. You're way too advanced for me. Okay. I write everything down, so please go ahead, read
the. To the honorable representatives of this board, I first want to thank you for holding this meeting. Since the beginning of the CPS case, my family has been through many obstacles to keep the fight for my nephews alive. I have watched my mother struggle with depression, losing weight due to stress and agony of not having them. My nephews were with my mother, brother, and I the majority of the time. It was very painful for me to watch this. I also watched my mother fight harder than she ever had. We are a very close family, and this has been extremely painful for all of us. My mother has put into action everything she thought CPS would want her to do. All of this to no avail, because CPS still continues to deny visitation and placement. The denial was based on visits they claim are not in the best interest of the children. My nephew lashes out when he is upset, so they took that as it was because of us. The truth is, he wanted so badly to come home, it upset him every time. There were so many things that was done to sabotage this case. The guardian ad litem did not conduct a thorough investigation and had not seen interaction between my nephews and family whatsoever. The GAL formed heavily weighted yet uninformed decisions. My family deserved better than this. My nephews deserve better than this. I can't imagine the feeling of abandonment they must feel. They are too young to understand that it isn't our doing. My nephew told his foster home, that no one loves him. My nephew had also stated he wanted to run away back to our home. The Supreme Court suggests that the family decisions should be left between the family. So why is this happening? My nephews belong at home with my mother and brother, where they are loved and cared for. We have a large family, and both my mother and grandmother are fighting together for them. My mother just passed an adoption home study done by Adoption Minnesota. So legally, there are no reasons. CPS, along with my sister, made up reasons of their own that have no truth to them. CPS needs to be reformed. It is attacking the heart of our country, the American family. When children have loving families, there is no reason for them to be separated. The other states that are offering a lump sum funding instead of per child have results are significantly lowered amount of children being placed in foster care. There are also many studies done where it is a fact that children do better in life if they are kept with their families, even if they are a bit troubled. Isn't this what we want, to keep families together? That is not what CBS is doing at this time. A family should not have to fight for their own children to be returned. The amount of money my mother has spent on attorney fees and other fees would be better spent on the children, wouldn't you agree? I believe children should remain at home during an investigation, and that funding should be given in a lump sum versus per child, and that the GAL should be required to visit with all family members. My nephews have been moved 6 times now. 2 of the homes there was narcotic use that my mother reported, and 1 home my nephew suffered abuse. We have not spoke to them in 4 months. We don't know where they are or if they are even alive. How does this happen?
And ma'am, I'm so sorry, but can you wrap up? And the other thing I would suggest is, could you email us that testimony too? Can you email it to us, and we can make sure everybody gets it? But if you could wrap up, that would be wonderful.
We keep waiting for justice. Honorable representatives, please give my family justice.
Thank you very, very much. And I really would appreciate an email so I can better understand the situation. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And as I mentioned earlier, the group that signed up after, here we go. We had it. If there was one more person that would like to testify, we have time for one more.
Madam Chair, my name is Nakima Levy-Pounds. I'm a civil rights attorney and a former law professor. This is an issue that I've studied for a very long time. I would like to respectfully request that these people be allowed to testify. As you look at your colleagues, you see that there are not any African Americans or other people of color represented. People who represent these systems had more than enough time to share what is happening in a broken system that has impacted these families. Mothers back here weeping after you told them that they could not testify, potentially until January. And that to me represents why so many of us feel as though we are second and third class citizens in this state. Our children are disproportionately suffering. So I respectfully ask that this committee allow these people the opportunity to say their piece on the record after the hell that they have been through on behalf of their children and their families.
Thank you.
I believe that Representative Kreisha had a comment that he'd like to make.
Thank you for that comment. A couple of things. As you see, Representative Moran from the House is not here, nor Senator Hayden from the Senate is here. You have representation, and so that's an unfair characteristic. Excuse me.
And you represent all of us. It's not just the African-American representatives on this board that represent us.
They are not present. Visually, we see no people of color on this panel, and these people have been through hell.
They should be allowed a few moments to testify. We shouldn't have to come in here, Madam Chair, and shut this place down.
Well, and if you... And I have there, if they were able to sign up beforehand, would be helpful because we ran out of time.
There were several people that were here before the doors opened and signed up, but you gave 20 minutes to speak. And I just think it's unfair
appreciate that I am not able to explain what's going on.
Are unable to speak at the legislative task force on child protection. We are requesting a legislative audit of child protective services as well as oversight because of the discriminatory practices within child protection. I've been coming here for the past 3 to 4 years asking that you all actively address disproportionality and disparities, and you failed to do so. The orders under Governor Dayton have brought in more families of color. We are experiencing a different child protection than what you all spend millions of dollars to discuss in so-called reform. We want these families to be heard, and hopefully it speaks to your humanity today.
That's right.
We are out of time. I am sorry. If you, we will sign you up for the next January, it's not just.
We're requesting a meeting.
To hear from these parents with the decision makers.
We will adjourn, and if
these were your children, and you're telling these people to come back in January, you're acting like you don't care.
I care.
What their children have been through.
We will.
Extremely disrespectful.
So is yelling at me from the audience. So is yelling at me.
We have a petition with over 300 signatures.
If anyone would like to stay on to listen, you are welcome to. We are adjourned.
That is so disrespectful. This is why we don't feel welcome at the legislature. The arrogance, the lack of humanity and compassion. And you all are the decision makers that contribute and not allow these people to be heard. It's so disrespectful. Madam Chair, it is so disrespectful. It is. And it's unacceptable what these families are going through. We're tired of it.
And we always request a meeting. We're always civil in the beginning, but now we'll have to disrupt. So we have to come to your offices.
But it's lunch that important?
No, are there people willing to stay
going
and
to your appointment?
To
I mean, this is your
okay,
job.
Okay, so there are people. There are for
this
those
is what
who
we want to do. We want to be heard.
There are people who are willing, and we thank you all for giving them. I just came with my baby to watch. But seeing this disrespect, I'm like, I have to speak up. Because it's unfair, and it's unjust, and it's just, it's wrong after what they've
Sorry.
Been through.
Sorry, I'm going to go first.
No, thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I come humbly to you today on behalf of me and my 5 children that was wrongfully taken from me out of my care. Caledonia, Minnesota has a 1% population of African American families. I was homeless, chronically, and desperate to bring stability to my family that I chose to live in their low-income housing. Little to my knowledge, I was an unwelcome intruder in their eyes and a victim before I even stepped foot on their soil. I was harassed for several months by officials, workers, and neighbors themselves, even before an opening of a child protection case. My children were separated from each other, overdiagnosed, abused by foster parents, and for 10 months we were denied access to each other. They are not culturally supported in any way, shape, or form. They have been depriving me of my children and has sold my children to the highest bidder. I'm exposed in Houston County for the thieves that they are, and they have hated and harassed me and my kids, tortured and subjected us to their racism. I hope that this exposure helps any other helpless families that comes against them in their low-income housing. The malicious acts of Houston County Human Services must be seen and heard. I have been my own lawyer, preparing my own appeals and court documents, advocating and networking within my means of being homeless, no income, living in my car, but still making a way to fight for my children's return. I'm begging and pleading that you hear my heart, not my heart, but my soul's cry, but especially for my 5 children who is hundreds of miles away from home in a deserted town that's unculturally supportive with hate being displayed to them every day that they wake up. They are all separated from the love of each other, from their fathers and their mothers. My children deserve the right to live a healthy, fulfilling, joyful life with their rightful family. I was preyed on and harassed and tortured, abused and regarded less than my civil rights had stated. They hated me and discriminated against me from the moment they laid eyes on me. My kids continue to be without the love of their mother and their healingness that they need in their culture. I completed everything that was asked and requested of me, and they continue to conspire against me and walk all over my God-given rights. My case is like others, but it looks as worse because it is what it looks like to go horribly wrong in a child protection case. I am asking unapologetically that you support and help our family. Give us rights. Give us special programs. Give us special laws, because my race is the biggest denominator of how I get treated with child protection. Go through the files. Investigate this office. I will not stop until my family receives the justice that we deserve. And if that includes federally suing this board, if that includes federally suing Department of Human Services, I'm going to exercise every right and procedure, because I will not allow Human Services to deprive me of my children and my destiny. I did not realize me living in this dreadful town would end up with me fighting for my life. I have been a mother since I was 15 years old, so this is my gift to nurture, and this is what I've been blessed with. This is my identity and the only thing that I know how to do best, and I am not going to allow them to rape me of it. I refuse to walk around this world lost and empty of me and who I am. Since this is all has happened to me, all of my goals and dreams have changed. All I desire is to walk my kids to their school bus and kiss them on their cheek while sending them off to school. And when they will return, I will have a meal waiting for them on the dining room table, looking each one of them in their eyes, grateful of their love and presence. But my dreams and goals don't stop there. I desire to tuck each of my children in at bed at night, watching them sleep in our home, in our community, in their beds, letting my love rain down all over them. So I pray that you're not just sitting here saying that you want to help, but you truly listen and you truly want to help not just the foster parents and not just the child protection and what they need. I mean, these families need to be together. We need to be together. We want you to give us, help us get our kids back. This is what we're asking. We want you to be authentic and we want you to be genuine. And from what I see today, I do not see that genuine authenticity right now. I feel like we're not being heard. It doesn't make any sense.
My name is Devontae Johnson Hall. I'm 23 years old. I'm a father to one beautiful baby girl in Asia. She's 1 year old, recently turned one. Mid-June 2017, the mother of my child went to the emergency room seeking medical attention, and they classified and judged her as a pill-seeking and drug user and such. They did a urine analysis test and were proved very wrong. CPS then did a background check, a routine background check of the father and mother's name who are on the birth certificate. I'm on the birth certificate. I do have a record. When I was 18 years old, I was convicted of kidnapping, fleeing the police of a motor vehicle, and theft of a motor vehicle and a robbery. In the midst of a robbery, I served 2 years, 10 months, successfully completed parole. I have not been in any trouble since. I've also successfully, since then, it's been about 5 years, have been completely law-abiding and followed all the rules when it comes to registering as a violent offender. Under Minnesota state law, I am an automatic threat to my child because of my record. And I knew there would be hardships with my record, but I didn't think that the hardships would come if I tried to do the right thing. That little girl saved my life, and here I am fighting for my rights just because I made a mistake. A bad choice. It wasn't a mistake. I made the choice. I made a bad choice when I was 18 years old, and I'm serving the consequences for it to this day.
He's involved with child protection because they're now threatening to terminate his rights.
Yeah.
He's contacted the department requesting that they provide information as to why, even though he was not the alleged offender or perpetrator in the child protection case, why they're threatening to terminate his rights. He was told that there is no case, that there is no petition, that there is no case number. He contacted the NAACP. I reached out to the county on his behalf, attempting to get some information as to why his rights are being terminated, and his social worker refused to speak with me. She said she was meeting with the judicial officers to determine if his rights were going to be terminated, but that he wasn't welcome at the meeting. This is one example of the injustice that African-American families face when dealing with child protection, and I'll let him continue.
I'm just basically being stonewalled, and I know CPS is the wrong people to lose patience with, obviously. but my patience is running really thin. Actions do speak louder than words, and I believe that hopefully after this meeting, you guys will show more attentiveness to these families just asking for help. And we just want to be put back together. Right is right, wrong is wrong, and it's clear to see. I made wrong choices. But I have an extensive work resume, and I'm sure you guys can get into whatever records to show that I haven't been in any trouble since. No same or similar crimes. None less than, no over than. I just want to be a father. I'm a new father. I went from being an irresponsible teenager to locked up to out, not knowing what I wanted to do, to being a father. And that's all I want to do for the rest of my life is be a father, and I'm being stonewalled from doing so.
One person got to make that decision, GAL and the judge. And I understand what they're saying. I could afford it. I can't even imagine what they go through not being able to afford that.
Okay. First of all, thank you guys for staying late so that you can hear our stories. My name is Arshima Jones. In 2012, my rights were terminated from my 5 children. Although the allegations in my case were proven.
Excuse me, I can't hear you. Could you?
Oh, sorry. In 2012, my rights were terminated from my 5 children. Although the allegations in my case were proven to be false and was only reported by one child, they took all of them. While in foster care, my children were abused, neglected, lied to, and diagnosed with different disorders. The foster parents told them that I didn't love them and that I didn't care about them and that they would never see me again. I was forced to do a case plan that was designed for me to fail because the details described in the case plan did not pertain to my family. Hennepin County wrongfully terminated my rights to my children. Since then, they have placed my children in 15-plus foster homes, and they are currently living in 3 different states and still have not been adopted. I'm here because I'm obviously able to parent my children. 2 years ago, there was a child placed in my home from Hennepin County. He is currently a ward of Hennepin County, and the social workers visit my home once a month to make sure that I'm rightfully and be taking care of him. But I'm not allowed to have my own children, which is obviously an issue. Once I reached out to NAACP and they start hearing my case and we start reaching out to the important parties, Hennepin County decided that they would try to take that child from my home because I shouldn't be allowed to foster a child, considering my rights were terminated. Again, Hennepin County put that child in my home. I do have parents, family members, loved ones that are able to parent my children, but again, they have been sent to different states in hopes to find a foster parent or someone to care for them. I'm here not only for myself, because obviously my rights have been terminated, but to help those who haven't gotten to that yet, who haven't had their rights terminated, who haven't had to go through this, and just to try to prevent that. We obviously need some kind of help, whether you do have money to take care of, to get a lawyer, or you don't have money to get a lawyer. We still need the help. We would appreciate if we felt like more people cared, because we don't. We don't feel like anybody cares. We don't feel like anybody is here for us, and that ultimately, they're out here just to take people's kids, and they're putting them in places where they're unsafe. They're not loved. They're not cared for. We have social workers in the audience here that are saying that they're just not able to do it all, and we have parents who just need help and resources and things, you know, like that. So that's all we're asking for. I'm not here to disrupt. I'm not here to
get upset. I'm not here to, I'm just here to ask for help for myself and for the parents, for other parents.
And can I add, her 15-year-old son reached out to the NAACP. He is currently in foster care. He reached out to the NAACP's Child Protection Committee because he had been placed in a foster home that he was removed from in 2015 for being abused in that foster home. Yes. He was placed in the same foster home because there were no other placement options available for him. How bad does it have to be for a 15-year-old to reach out to the NAACP for help? He has been in over 15 placements. Since we've begun advocating for these two children's, the two oldest children's placement with relatives, there are four relatives available who's a teacher and two of them are foster parents that the county refuses to place these kids with. Since the NAACP has been advocating for these children, they've opened a new case on this mother attempting to take her husband's son from the home because they have the power and ability to do so. We are here today, again, not to disrupt, but to really ask for some legislative oversight as to the decisions that are being made by Child Protective Services. DHS's own data illustrates what we're sharing with you today. We will respectfully request a meeting to follow up as to the petition and the recommendations that were made in that petition. We have over 300 signatures, and we'll continue to circulate that petition until we have more. But we would like to really sit down to discuss the issue of disproportionality and disparate outcomes. This is not a black issue. When we fix this, we fix case overload. Yes. When we fix this, we fix the issue of worker retention. Yes. When we fix this, we fix the issue of a lack of foster home availability. So it's not just a black issue. When we get serious about it, we won't have to flush so much money down the drain, getting more foster homes and mental health assessors and all. It's a big business that is, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be. It could be corrected if we start here. And that's what we're requesting. Thank you.